Okay, it's 1 o'clock Central Standard Time, so I want to invite everybody, or thank everybody for showing up at the Journey meeting this month. We had some special guests scheduled. We didn't get those, so we're just going to kind of wing it today with some announcements first, and then anybody that wants to share things, then we'll be able to share things. First off, I'm David Knight. For anybody that doesn't know who I am, Casey's off to my backside here. And Brian's right there in the audience. We are Project JFK CSI Dallas. And this is our third monthly meeting called The Journey. It's a free event. Everybody gets an email invite. But in case you know people that should be here and they don't get an email, please forward the email that you receive to them so that way they can join as well. Our next point of business is I want to let everybody know April the 17th. Next month is going to be our next Journey meeting, the fourth meeting in the series. And then on April the 30th, May 1st, and May 2nd is going to be our 2021 Turbulent 60s conference. It's a global conference. We are going to have some people from the Kansas City area, and we're going to have a group of students in from Illinois, along with Professor David Denton. So they'll be actually doing kind of a on remote learning classroom. And then we're going to also have this virtual. So all of our speakers will be able to, talk to the virtual audience, and they'll also be able to talk to the students. Again, that's going to be April 30th, May 1st, May 2nd. More details will be put up on projectjfk.com. The adult ticket price is going to be $60. Student price is $40. And for those of our speakers, you'll get a, you won't have to pay for, obviously you're a speaker, you're not going to have to pay for the event, but, you will get a email with your, login information as we get closer. And we'll have, we're going to have roughly 24 to 25 speakers.
Wow.
It's going to be 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 7-ish. Central Standard Time on Friday, Saturday, and then we're going to go from about 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. The list of speakers will be posted along with a schedule later on this week coming up. And then also there'll be an Eventbrite tab that you'll be able to click on. Hi, Gary. You'll be able to click on and purchase your tickets at the link on the website, projectjfk.com. So, let's see here who we've got in the audience. There's my boy, Larry. Hey, Larry, why don't you give us an update on what's going on with your letter to Washington and to Congress and to your statesman.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, great. Thanks. So, as you know, last time we spoke, I was drafting a letter to the House Oversight Committee, and I sent the letter. I also have been in touch with the general counsel of the committee to confirm that they have received it. They have. And Congress is going to be in recess for the last 2 weeks of March for Easter. So I don't anticipate getting any response until the beginning of April. In the meantime, I have also prepared, or in the final stages of preparing, a letter to the Senate Homeland Security Committee, which is the new version of the committee in the Senate that has the jurisdiction in the Senate over the JFK Records Act. And while I'm sending it to the chair of that committee, Gary Peters, who I think is from Indiana, maybe, or Illinois, or he's somewhere in the Midwest. I'm also copying Charles Grassley and Patrick Leahy. They were the co-sponsors, although they're from the Judiciary Committee, they were the co-sponsors of the 2017 resolution that the Senate passed, and the House passed a similar resolution urging the release of all the records. So I'll be sending that letter out, and I'll also follow it up with a letter to the general counsel of that committee. we're asking for oversight hearings to be held before the soft deadline that NARA has established for the agencies to indicate to NARA whether they're going to request further postponement, which is, I believe, April 26 is the soft deadline. The hard deadline was October 26. That's when they have to comply. In addition, I've organized a group of lawyers who are exploring our options. We believe that the 2017 postponement, or actually technically April of 2018, we believe that postponement was not done in accordance with the requirements of the JFK Records Act, principally because the records, there was supposed to be a clear and convincing showing on a document-by-document basis as to why the enumerated grounds for postponement outweigh the public interest in seeing the records released. They were supposed to make, in other words, they're supposed to make a finding per document identifying what the grounds were for postponement and then explain how this ground exceeded the public interest. They didn't do that. They just made a generalized statement that the way it worked was the archivist of the United States recommended to the president that they delay for until 2021. So there are other also areas where the act has not been complied with, but that's the principal ground. So we're exploring, I think I've identified at least two grounds that we could seek that have not been used in previous litigation. It's outside of the FOIA Act, but we're still exploring that. We are meeting weekly, and we'll probably, you know, we have some Washington lawyers involved as well, as lawyers from across the country, and actually a lawyer from Canada as well. And we'll be exploring our options. And I guess by your meeting up for April 30th, we should have some further news about whether we're either reached out to NARA and indicated whether they're going to cooperate or whether we're going to have to sue. We're also thinking about including the JFK Library, because I wasn't aware of this, or I may have forgotten, that within an hour of the president's death, Bobby Kennedy contacted Bundy and asked, who owns the president's records? Is it the president or is it the government? And the answer was that the president owned the records. This is obviously pre-Nixon. So basically Bobby changed all the locks on the safes, and not only did he take the lots of files, but he also took tapes. They do not appear to be any tapes from the taping system discussing Cuba from 1963, I believe, that are in the public domain. There are other tapes, but not those involving Cuba. So I think that those have not been released, and I believe that the Bobby Kennedy materials are still being sequestered at the library. We have to verify that, but we may include the library as well as a defendant. We'll have probably more information for you for the annual meeting, or whatever you call that meeting. So I will be submitting the letter to Senate next week. They'll be gone for 2 weeks, so I don't anticipate hearing anything till April. Obviously, the Congress has got lots of things going on. I think this is not going to be a priority, but we're going to try to – our group also includes Jeff Morley, and so he's going to be helping us on the publicity side to try to build some pressure. We want to make it harder for the agencies not to approve the they have to affirmatively request. If they don't request postponement, the records will be released. So we want to make it hard for them to make that request. So if you guys have any ideas, about other potential defendants that you want us to explore. But we're looking at this creatively, and we're also looking to see what the right venue is, because I know the District of Columbia courts are very pro pro-government, pro-secrecy, and I think we can find something elsewhere, another venue that's more amenable. Bill, do you want to add anything?
Just a couple things. One is the Malcolm X records are an issue that's very high for a lot of people right now because of the revelations in that case over the last 12 months, the film and more. And so at some point we might be able to join forces with that group of people in some kind of creative way. Their focus is mainly in New York, which is where the special services records are. The Red Squad records. They're very similar to the Red Squad records in the Kennedy case in Dallas. Same groups were active throughout the country. And the other thing I was just going to say is what makes me have a lot of hope about this case is that Trump made a big mistake by announcing just days before the release that he was going to release everything and then doing a complete 180. And I think he got told by, you know, various people that it was too hot an issue for him to take on. And so they dropped doing the document by document review, which they really got to do. And, in a sense, I think we'll be doing ourselves a favor by pushing this document by document review right at the beginning of this campaign.
Right.
So I'm hopeful.
Yeah. And, apparently the Secretary of State is the one that really pushed hard, back on it. From what I hear. But, that's kind of definition of arbitrary capricious, Bill, right?
Right.
It's like suddenly just change his mind. And the fact that it's Trump, we have some circuits that, you know, have the history of looking askance at his decisions and actually overturning his orders. So we're going to probably do some venue shopping, try to find a court. If our research goes in a direction where – it looks like it's going. We may do something outside of Washington to try to enhance the chances of getting, getting past the preliminary stage of being thrown out of court for lack of standing or lack of having a right to bring an action. But we'll keep you guys posted. We can't get into too much detail on the legal ideas. We just have to keep some of those quiet because you never know. Somebody may leak it out and we don't want our potential opponents to learn too early. But we'll keep you appraised of where we're going with that.
Larry, Dan yeah. Stover here. A reminder, the HSCA files for both JFK and Martin Luther King are scheduled, are held until 2027, I believe is the year. So, you know, that's an important set of documents. You know, I was hoping that you could incorporate that.
Eventually, if we get some traction with Congress, that's certainly an idea, as Bill was mentioning, but between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, you know, if we can get traction in Congress, if we're going to litigation, that's a whole separate story. We have, Congress never held hearings on the 10 recommendations that the ARB made. And many of those recommendations are very valid for today's times because they're about the over-secrecy of the government and, you know, the need. And Congress has done things since then, but they haven't actually responded or even held a hearing on those specific recommendations because they weren't just focused on the JFK Records Act. It actually was an example. You know, if you haven't read the final report in a while, it's worth rereading. It's a wonderful document. And every time I read it from a different perspective, it's a good document. And they have 10 recommendations, and many of them, you know, predicted what was going to happen in the last two decades with this ever-growing government secrecy, and that's a big issue now. So.
Yeah, sorry, I meant 2029, not 2027, 50 years after the ending of the announcing what they're...
We want to put pressure. So there's two things, Dan. One is to get Congress, you know, to hold hearings, and to the extent that, you know, bring in Morton and maybe Malcolm in to help do that. That's one thing. The litigation is a different matter. The grounds for bringing the lawsuit will be based on the president and the archive is not complying with the JFK Records Act. That's a different issue than with Martin Luther King. Those records are, you know, those that's more of a FOIA issue, whereas this is outside of FOIA. This is just they didn't comply with the law, and anyone, anytime an agency, it's like when I sue an environmental agency, you know, if they don't comply with their statute or their regulations, you sue them. Same thing here. The government, the president, and the archivist did not comply with the law, the requirements.
Yeah.
So, whereas opposed to Martin, it's a little separate issue that there are congressional records that surprisingly are exempt. So we have to figure out a way to deal with that. But that's a separate issue.
Well, the interesting thing about that issue is that the family has changed its opinion in the last 10 years. They are now willing to try to push to get these records released before 2029, which is a 180 for them. And I think it's because they just aren't as concerned about the sexual indiscretion issue as they were in the past.
I see there's a comment here about reaching out to the Black Caucus. So if people, I'm focusing on the two committees for the JFK Records Act. If any of you know or have ideas about the Black Caucus, who to speak to, who to contact. I got my hands pretty full with this thing, so we'll probably need to have a separate group bill to push on the Martin, at least initially, and then see if we can bring them together. I don't know what you know. I'm just talking extemporaneously now, Bill. So.
No, that's fine. We can talk about it offline too.
Yes. Okay.
All right. I want to go ahead and throw in something here real quick. Thank you again, Larry and Bill, for giving us the update on that. I'm going to do a screen share here real quick. Since last month's journey meeting here, we've got a new update on the Project JFK website that I want to show. Okay. If you go to the Shaw Legacy tab and click on it and you scroll down, the fourth item down is the first generation copy of notes of Jack Ruby smuggled out of the Dallas County Jail and bought by Penn Jones Jr. These were on Gary Shaw's collection. There's 33 pages. It is a PDF. And Brian has sat down and transcribed all 33 of these pages. So that way, because sometimes it's kind of hard to read somebody's handwriting, he's taken the time to go in and transcribe these notes, and those will be going up as well. You'll see this, and then right below will be the transcribed notes. So I just want to thank Gary Shaw for giving us the Ruby letter so we can put that on his tab on the website. And also I want to go over here to the event section and let everybody know that the meeting for last month, if you missed it, it is on the website. This is hosted on YouTube, so it'll take you to YouTube. That's a great picture of me, I tell you what.
Casey. Look at Casey in the background.
Yeah. Yeah. Candid moments. We love those. But anyway, if you want to go back and see last month's video, you're more than welcome to do that. You can watch it on here, or you can full screen it, go on to YouTube and watch it. There's plenty of videos on YouTube. That's also on our video section here on the website that you can check out things that, you know, you may not have seen. Of course, I like the subscribe button. So if you like what we're doing, definitely hit the subscribe button. And anybody that hasn't seen A Meeting of the Minds with Dr. Michael Chesser, Jim Jenkins, William Law, and Dr. Mantic, please go in and watch that. I know it's about a two and a half hour intimate setting. The first 5 to 7 minutes of the video is a little fuzzy, but the rest of it is okay. But it's the it's a great video to watch, and there's a lot of stuff that Jim Jenkins comes out and tells in private in this meeting than what he actually said at like Lancer's conference. So it's a great place to go in and check out that video as well. And there's plenty of stuff, and more stuff's getting added as as time goes by. So I just want to let everybody know that, you know, keep checking the website, and, you know, you never know what you're going to see pop up. And there's an affiliated website part that you can go in, and it will take you to any of the websites that you may want to visit, or you visited in the past, but you forgot the address. It's easier just to click on the site and take the hyperlink right to somebody's website. So with that, let me stop the share here. Okay. Casey, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, I want to at least tell all our individuals that are online right now and who have been online with us, and especially the lawyers. Guys, we're in the middle of 58 years of doing research just on the murder of John F. Kennedy, and we couldn't have gotten this far without some really good down-to-earth lawyers that will go after aspects of our government and try to do it in a way that we are above board. And I say that because, as you all know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there, and there's a lot of other websites that cater to a lot of different things. But I at least want to hand it back to those particular lawyers. And I know we have several with us today. We've got Larry and Bill, and I'm certainly several others. But at the same time, if we couldn't have gotten this far in 58 years without you guys' help and without your endurance after 58 years. Of course, the other thing, too, is my wife, after the 50th anniversary, she says, "Is it all over?" And I said, "Is it all over?" I said, "You got to be kidding me." I said, "They're just starting to open some of the archives." And I said, "I don't know if I have 50 more years left, but I'm certainly going to pass this on to somebody." And that's part of what our legacy is here, is trying to keep this thing alive as much as we possibly can, and hand it down to some people who would really like to get into this and understand from our point of view as citizens, you know, what is going on. But a round of applause for all of you lawyers that have really gone out of your way for the past 58 years to provide us with the opportunity to look into these aspects of the murder of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and any of the other 1960 murders that have taken place. So hands up, round of applause for you guys. Thank you guys very much.
I just want to throw something in here real quick. Let me turn the screen share back on. And a quick deal here. Brian just put up in the comment section, and that's why I'm going to talk about this. I guess we don't have the 33 pages. We're working on the 33 pages of deciphering. But if you go on to the events tab and you look down here where it says downloads, anything that's being said in our chat log is a PDF or a text document you can download. So if anybody puts up great information, they put up websites, links that people should be clicking on, and you're like, "Oh, we went through the meeting, I forgot to write it down, or I didn't get it as fast as they were speaking and going on," you can go on here, and these will usually be up to within 24 hours after our meeting. So today's meeting and text file should be up by tomorrow at 1 o'clock. You can go on here and you can download the chat log. And then if you have a YouTube downloader or any video converter and you want to save the video and view later offline, you can always do that with any of our YouTube videos.
So, Casey, to your point about your wife, you know, as I tell my friends what I'm doing, they are astounded that, you know, why are you wasting your time with the Kennedy assassination? We have so many things going on right now. And I just tell them that, first of all, that it's, you know, still important. And second of all, there's plenty of people working on the problems we're facing now. And this is very important to those of us who saw our president killed. And it's the factors that and forces that contributed to it then are still influencing our government now. So, but it's amazing how many people our age, who are just so concerned about our country's direction right now, that they don't have any bandwidth for something that happened 60 years ago. It's just surprising to me when I tell them what I'm doing. They think I'm wasting my time.
Well, Larry, thank you again, and all those other lawyers that are doing this. Jim Lazar and all of those people who have been trying to give us insight. And I know when I first read your letter, I started laughing, not because of the content of the letter, but basically when I started looking at it, I said, my God, I said, Snap is really the lawyer, because he is really writing in a terminology that you have to present it in a lawyeristic form. And it's not just a nice letter that you're writing to do this. And I appreciate what you've done. So I told obviously my wife and several other individuals, I said, I will be the Thomas Paine here and do a little comment. And you understand what I'm talking about. But at the same time, I said, okay. And I said, I'm probably reaching a little bit too far when I say common sense. I'm not even sure if common sense is even out there anymore. I'm about ready to pull my hair out on some things. And if you look at David, he's already pulled most of his hair out. So.
Oh, that's what happened?
That's what happened. That and three kids, yeah, trust me, you'll lose your hair quickly. I did not grow gray gracefully or recede hairline gracefully. All right. Well, I tell you what, let's find out. Let's ask the audience out here. Does anybody have something they would like to share with us? Anybody?
Come on, Bart.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, Bart, yeah, our encore.
Not going to be around like last time. I saw the video back, and I turned it off after 10 or 12 seconds. I was like, shut up. Yeah, I never watch my own stuff back. So I mentioned this last time a little bit, that I was looking into the whole Heidel ID thing, and I published the article about, I think, a week or 2 weeks ago. And what it comes down to is that going through all the paperwork that's available as such, in a nutshell, you know, look, I don't look into the Heidel ID before or after the assassination weekend. I only look at what's happening to the Heidel ID during the weekend as such. So, and the main finding is that on November 22nd, no one made mention of the Heidel ID. On the 23rd, the first person that makes mention of it is Manning Clements of the FBI, who allegedly walks in by his Warren Commission testimony that he says, I was there at 10 o'clock. But that's rubbish, because Marlon G. Hall, that's the Dallas police detective with the glasses on that escorts Oswald all the time, he's very good at timing things. His report is filled with timing and basically puts Clemens's arrival at around 7:40. Now, 7:40 is the time when Oswald walks through the corridor and declares himself to be a patsy. But he's actually there a bit before that, because he mentions that he's sitting there and tries to interrogate Oswald while then Oswald is being taken out for a lineup. Now, that's only at that time, that's the Davis sisters lineup at that time. And according to his report written on the 23rd, he says that he basically starts looking at the evidence that's been collected and is spread out over a table in the room next door. So you've got five arresting officers that are named. You know, you've got Bentley, you've got Gerald Hill and three others. And they make no mention of the so-called Heidel ID at all. During that day, Hill is interviewed twice. Bentley is interviewed once the next day as well at WFAA. Doesn't say a word at all, doesn't make a mention of it at all. What's even more significant is that he doesn't make a mention of it in the first week of December either at all. So Clemens says that he basically saw that the ID lying in between all the stuff from his billfold as such. But then there's another issue. First of all, there's Hostie. And Hostie was only there during the first interrogation. And then, according to his book, he basically went into the office next door, which was Walter E. Potts' office. And he basically started taking notes and looked at the material as well. He doesn't make a mention of this ID either. Will Fritz, who interrogates him 3-4 times, doesn't make a mention of this either. And on Saturday, the 23rd, lo and behold, in the morning, they find a so-called order for Alec J. Heidel. And at the end of the first interrogation of Oswald on the 23rd, James Booker brings up the Heidel ID. Fritz doesn't do this, but Booker does. So to me, I find that really hard to connect with, well, it connects really nicely after the find of the rifle to bring in the ID at that time. That to me was quite a significant find from the interrogations to looking into. The other thing I've been looking into, this is for the second time, is the Raleigh call. It started with AJ Weberman and somebody else whose name just escapes me. And Henry Hurt did a bit on it. He interviewed a few people, his wife, for instance, Hurt's wife. And, of course, Grover Proctor, of course, did it for the last 40-odd years. I think he started in 1980, something like that. And I wrote about it in a summarized way about 2 years ago, and I said my headline was "The Rally Call Never Happened." And the reason for that was that from the documentation that's available about Oswald and his phone calls, you got to remember that Oswald didn't phone anyone or was able to phone anyone for almost 24 hours after his arrest, and that he wanted John Abt to represent him as such. Now, what we know is that Oswald made at least 3 calls that day on the 23rd, around, I think, 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and 8 o'clock, I think. And, decided to talk about it as well. Bear with me. And basically, all these calls have been recorded, and also they had reports made up in 1964 about these calls and to whom too. What we also know is which numbers Oswald called, because there are records of that, and also further investigation of these phone calls, where they were to. And they were mostly to try and get hold of Abt, and of course he called Ruth Payne, because he wanted to get hold of Marina, but Marina was long gone by that point. And on top of that, you look at the HSCA statements of Louise Swinney, who is the person that did the call, the alleged call to Hurt. And you then have Alveda Trion and Sharon Kovach. And Sharon Kovach is the daughter of Alveda Trion. And if you look at the documentation, it contradicts itself, each other, left, right, and center. Then, as a bonus, they get the hold of John Hurt, and John Hurt completely disowns it. But then Henry Hurt, no relation, gets to interview John Hurt's wife, because John Hurt died in 1981, and he interviews her in 1982. And apparently, John Hurt was really drunk that night on November the 23rd, and basically tried to get hold of Oswald. So, more than just a crazy call, it can't be more than that, since there's absolutely no record of it, and there was no real outgoing call. The real biggest problem is the fact that the so-called call slip, the call slip was written by Alveda Trion. Louise Swinney completely disowns the signature and the name Hurt as such as well, because she emphatically stated that Oswald wanted to talk to Abt and not Hurt. And there was another number, another person that he wanted to talk to, but she didn't remember that. When she saw the slip, she completely disowned it and said, "That's not me. That's not my thing. I wrote it on a blue piece of paper instead of that call slip." Then the whole thing about picking out the wastebasket also gets contradicted. So there's so much wrong with it that it's like no one would actually ever believe it. That's what I'm working on now. The next thing is going to be the fingerprints, which is also a complete mess. Again, I'm only looking at the weekend and the fingerprints. I'm not bothered about New Orleans or his Marine Corps fingerprints and so forth, whether they match or not. There's just there's only one set of fingerprints available through the archives, whether it's from the FBI records or from the Secret Service or the DPD, whereas the DPD actually took several different sets of Oswald's fingerprints as such. And there's at least, I know that when they put on this dog and pony show in front of all the cameras and they show two sets of cards, they do it really quick. Neither set I can find anywhere else reproduced than in that particular movie clip. And then I found another still photo that shows the second set that they, because the best way to actually find out about this is that the fingerprint cards have 10 squares, and it's the matter of how it's printed onto in these so-called squares, where it's touching the line or it goes over the line and so forth. So it's relatively easy to compare these bits as such. So that's what I'm in the middle of right now. So that's that.
All right, well, thank you, Bart. I just wanted to throw something up here real quick. The transcribed Ruby letters we spoke about a few minutes ago, they are now uploaded. They are on the website. Right below the handwritten ones, you can find the typed transcribed letters.
Cool.
I'd like to make a comment. This is Tim Nicholson.
Hey, Tim.
Is this Casey?
Yeah.
Yeah, Casey. Former CIA director James Woolsey has come out and claimed that the Russian government, under the direction of Premier Nikita Khrushchev, assassinated Kennedy. Yeah, I think there was an article on that. Does anybody have any comments about this? Because that's kind of what I would consider to be a rather reckless and a claim without any evidence to back that up. Any comments on that? I mean, this is a current event in blaming the Soviet Union or Russia for this event.
Well, perhaps this is the first strike that they're going to, if they release all the records, they'll have to explain why they kept them all these years. Maybe this is going to be the excuse that, well, we thought it was going to cause a world war, so therefore, in the greater good, we kept these from being released, but who knows.
Hello, everyone. This is Doug Campbell. How you doing?
Hey.
Hey, Doug.
Hey, Doug.
Hey, Douglas.
You know what this sounds like to me? Do you guys remember, I know everyone here is aware of Rolf Moet Larsen.
Yeah. He spoke at the conference in Lancer a couple of years ago, CIA guy from Moscow.
Yeah.
This sounds like to me, you know, well, you had an ex-CIA agent. We've got an ex-director. Like they're trying to trump him with this information, if that makes any sense. You know, because he was a mid to high-level CIA guy. And although he does say that Oswald did it, there's also that, you know, that mea culpa, that limited hangout that Esterline and J. Walton Moore were involved, you know. So it's almost like they're countering with disinformation, but they're trying to trump the source. You know, you've got an experienced CIA guy. Well, we've got a director, and he says it was Castro and Khrushchev. That make any sense?
Well, it does to me. And also, my concern is this guy, Woolsey, with the CIA, wrote this book with a guy named Ian Scarseppa, something like that. He was a former intelligence officer on the East Bloc side of things. And he wrote a whole book earlier, which is just a terrible book, about Oswald in Mexico City. I can't recommend anybody even waste their time reading it because it's not documented. It's poorly sourced, I should say. And it doesn't jive with the documents. And frankly, it's the worst kind of conspiracy theory. And for Woolsey to hang out with this guy, I think it's really an act of desperation.
Well, I know Rolf is writing a novel that's going to kind of, or maybe a book. I'm not sure if it's novel, fiction or nonfiction, but he's going to expand upon what he said at the Kappa conference. I spoke to him about 2 months ago. So I don't know if that's in response to that. I mean, obviously he has to get stuff approved if he's bringing in the CIA and revealing anything. That could be. But, you know, he's going around. He's very public, Ralph, now. So he's done. So that might, you might be right, Doug. There may be some pushback in that area. But
yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking, man. Maybe it's good to meet you, Mr. Schnapp. Finally, by the way.
I'm Larry. This.
Involved.
But Woolsey's a curious person to rely on.
I wanted to read, if I could, maybe a two-minute snippet out of my book, because I've got an item or two that I thought people might be interested in regarding the possible impersonation of Oswald.
Go ahead, Bill.
Would that be apropos?
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay.
Impersonation where?
What I'm looking at in particular is the period in Irving in 1963. And I'm going to summarize it real quick. I don't want to take up a lot of time, but I wanted people to know that this is in my book. It's in part 12 of the 12 who built the Oswald legend, which is on Mary Farrell. And the four people I'm looking at the hardest right now are the Irving grocer named Leonard Hutchison, and the Irving barber, Cliff Chastain. And then Albert Bocard and Jack Lawrence, because they worked under the Triple Underpass, that Lincoln Mercury site. And then finally, the rifle range in Grand Prairie, where Michael Payne lived. And my point is this, is that Hutchison, the Irving grocer, remembered Harvey Oswald trying to cash a $189 two-party check. It wasn't a payroll check. That was a lot more money than Oswald got paid. And he identified him as weighing more like 160 pounds, which is like 20, 30 pounds too high, and that he had plenty of hair. It doesn't look to me like he's Harvey Oswald, but the next guy's even worse. This is my favorite, Cliff Chastain, the Irving barber. He said that he saw Oswald drive Ruth Payne's car to the barbershop and said, I'm sure it's a 1955 Chevrolet station wagon, either blue or white or green and white, which was just like Ruth Payne's. And Chastain's brother-in-law lived right across the street from Ruth Payne. And so what's really weird about it is Chastain gave this Oswald figure like 5 to 7 haircuts. But Oswald had only lived in Irving for like a month, month and a half. It's an awful lot of haircuts for that short period of time. More to the point, he also said that he came in, there was a young kid, 14 years old, who came in with him 3 times with Oswald. And not only did this kid come inside, but he would talk about how the country needed to give black people the same rights as whites, how the country needed a communist type system. This is a 14-year-old boy here. And that's not a way to make yourself popular either. And when he came in for his last haircut, the young kid, he came in a couple of days before the assassination without Oswald. He's attacking the country, its greed, and even how Cliff Chastain wouldn't share the profits at his barbershop. Chastain wanted to take the razor strap to him. And Chastain was the future mayor and city councilman of the city of Irving. He's not just a barber. He knew everybody in town. He looked all over Irving for this boy, and he couldn't find him. Now, the interesting thing is Ruth Payne did have one student, and he was about 14 years old, and he was a Russian student, learning Russian. And so, you know, Greg Parker has suggested that this young boy might be him, which is a good guess. But I would go one step further and say, I think this kid might have been impersonated himself, just like Oswald. Oswald, I don't think, was driving Ruth Payne's car that day. And I don't think that that Oswald ever came in this barbershop at all, frankly. And then you've got a similar story from Albert Bogart and Jack Lawrence about the Lincoln Mercury. What's so interesting about this, I'm going to let you guys read it, but Albert Bogart didn't want to go public with the story that Oswald came in driving 80 miles an hour. Everybody tried to shut that story up. But Jack Lawrence, who was an operative who had worked on the anti-Castro forces in the past, came forward and said, you know, he went to the FBI and announced that Oswald came in there that day, which got him fired. And To make a long story short, Jack Lawrence is a highly suspicious character. He lived at the YMCA at the same time as Oswald, a whole bunch of things. And you got to ask yourself, did Jack Lawrence, was this whole Oswald story buried in this Lincoln Mercury Center specifically to pop out the day after the assassination? And one thing I didn't know, I know Gary Shaw knows this, is that Jack Lawrence and Albert Bogart worked in this Lincoln Mercury site. It was right under the Triple Underpass. It's just a few blocks from the book depository.
Can I just add one thing regarding the haircuts?
Sure, go ahead.
Oswald was mocked for his long hair, and they told him to get a haircut. So that contradicts already, for one part, already the Chastain story, if he's gone to the hairdresser so often, yet at the same time had hair in his neck and basically was mocked for not having a haircut as such.
Well, thank you.
One more thing, just completely unrelated, but I just want to drop it in there real quick.
Yeah.
At the top of this chat log, I basically put two links up. These are Mongoose documents. These are very rare. I checked the riffs online, and it draws a complete blank. There is no trace of this stuff whatsoever if you put the riffs in. It's a total of 270 pages, so if Mongoose is the stuff that you like to look at, because I got them sent this morning by Malcolm, and I scanned them in right away, they're available, and you can drag them from those links right away. That's it.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention one or two final things about this whole theory I'm working on about Oswald being impersonated on a few select occasions. And it wasn't just him who got impersonated. I think there was a number of impersonations, if you will, of Ruth Payne's vehicle, both that day with Chastain, as well as on 11/22. And one other thing about Chastain I should mention is that he was an FBI informant in the past, and he was reporting on communists back in the 1950s. And it's all in the book. The last couple of things I wanted to mention was that the Grand Prairie's Sportstrom. I think one thing that's very interesting is that the Dallas Morning News editor said that he had a tip that Michael Payne had passed a rifle over the fence. Michael Payne, by the way, lived in the same town as the Sportstrom Grand Prairie. I think all these sightings of Ruth and Michael and their car, and then Marina and Lee Oswald and even Frazier, I think this whole period of time, you got to really ask yourself whether these were doped up sightings, because they're contradicted by much better corroborated findings that they were not on these dates, on these times in question. Up to and including even the Dial Rider event where Oswald supposedly brought in his rifle to have it fixed up. It seems like it's a different rifle. The people who worked at the shop when he was looking for Dial Rider do not appear to have been Lee and Marina. So that's in the epilogue, that last one. So this whole sequence I'm looking at really, really hard. And I'm spending a lot of time going back into the Dallas-Fort Worth period between 59 to 63. And I'm going to report on that next month at our little conference on April 30th. So if anybody has any good information on Irving, Texas, and these characters, please give me a heads up. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. I want to at least say that I know several of you guys are in contact with a gentleman by the name of Brooks LaPlante, and Brooks is going to do a presentation for us at our global conference. And speaking with him online and on the phone and listening to you and reading your meticulousness into the research of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Brooks is doing some of the best work out there, Casey.
There is no doubt in my mind. I was on the phone with him 5 hours and then just this past week, and then he got on the phone with David for another 5 hours. But I said, Brooks, you need to synthesize this and present this as much as you possibly can, because this research is necessary. And a lot of the ordinary everyday people want flat, straight out answers. They're not going to get it unless they see the actual research. So I'm going to point out Brooks again. Like you said, he is doing fabulous research, and hopefully we'll be able to hear from him in our next journey. And then he'll be at the global research conference.
I had a question for the audience on some of the forensic evidence. Can I get some comments on from everybody about people who smelled gun smoke in the motorcade?
Well, my bias, I get this from Tink Thompson's new book. Tink is of the opinion that the gunpowder that was smelled emanated from the knoll, and that, at least in his opinion, I don't know if he's right or not, it wasn't firecrackers, but it was actually a knoll shooter. I agree with him about the knoll shooter, and I wonder if there weren't firecrackers as well, because it would be a great diversion.
Well, I have something to add that I read in Crossfire by
Jim Marsh.
By Jim Marsh, yeah, I have a picture of myself with him. And he said that there was a policeman standing over a catwalk over the Stemmons Freeway, which was southeast of the plaza. And this policeman smelled gun smoke about a couple of minutes after the shootings. And it turns out that the vehicles to enter the Stemmons Freeway would have to enter on the left-hand side of the freeway enter on the left lane. And this policeman was standing directly in a place where the wind was blowing right up, straight up Elm Street, according to what I've studied. So it seems like there's a possibility that the gun smoke could have been trapped in one of the vehicles. That's something I'd like people to think about.
Well, if I could throw something in here, in our book, Beyond the Fence Line, we talked about that. That was Officer Brown with the Dallas PD. He was supposedly stationed on top of the train viaduct that goes over Stemmons, but we don't know where in the hell he was in the first place. But anyway, his report, his daily activity report says that he smelled that smoke 40 minutes after the motorcade went through. I have no idea how he would do that. But that's what he wrote is I smelled gunpowder, a strong sense of gunpowder 40 minutes after the cars passed. So I don't know if you can take that, you know, as verbatim what actually took place. I would find that highly suspicious in a court of law, how you would ever have that smell 45 minutes after the 40 minutes after the fact. I don't know how you do that.
Well, Jim Marsh said it was 2 minutes.
Yeah. You read his testimony or read his affidavit. He clearly says 40 minutes after the fact, and we don't know where he was. I mean, even though these officers had a duty to be at a specific spot, we don't have any photographs of him. He just said he was on the overpass, but we don't, you know, how you know, you know, you got a lot of walking to do. One of the things that I learned from Gary Shaw was not to go down a rabbit hole, but I went down a rabbit hole the other day. And I'm still trying to get back out of it. Bart, I'm going to plug your website, Dallas, the Dealey Plaza Echo or Dealey Plaza UK. If you have not been on that, I would suggest you go on there. There is a collection on there from Ian Griggs that is absolutely vital to understanding the inside workings of the Dallas Police Department. And he's interviewed a lot of people. But one of the things that I went down that rabbit hole, there's an interview he did of Johnny Brewer. And I know Gary's always told me, if it doesn't have anything to do with the case, you know, let's not focus so much on it. But this is, from a law enforcement standpoint, this has got me intrigued. And I keep reading this and trying to figure this out. Does anybody know if there was an IBM business anywhere in the Oak Cliff area in 63? Well, think about that for a minute, because I want to read you just a real quick snippet of his interview with Johnny Brewer.
This is great stuff. Great stuff. I agree with you, Brian.
Casey and I interviewed Johnny Brewer a couple times when he talked to our kids. You know, the guy's a nice guy, but I'm not sure I believe everything he says. but his memory was seemed to be clear when he talked to Ian. And this is from 1997 in volume one, number three of the Dealey Plaza Echo. And I'm just paraphrasing it. But Ian talked to him and asked him about that day. He got, you know, he wasn't supposed to be at work that day. He had a new car and he was, you know, called into work at the last minute. So he shows up and he's talking about seeing this person, this customer of his, who he later said was Lee Oswald. He said, Ian asked him, now we're obviously leading up to your view of this man acting strangely. When this happened, John, were you in the shop by yourself? And Johnny Brewer says, there were two other men in the store. They were from IBM. They were in the neighborhood. I had known them since I came here. And Ian asks the great follow-up question, were these customers? No, they weren't customers. They just came in and killed time lounging around in the shoe store. Who does that? I think I'm wondering if he's, when he says IBM, if he meant CIA or FBI. But anyway, so Johnny goes on and tells his story that he follows this customer into the, walks up to the theater, and Ian asks him, so he says that's why you stepped out of the store and looked, and he was walking down there by Thompson's and he was still walking. He says, okay, now I understand he entered the Texas Theater. Right, I saw him go in. Ian asks, okay, from your vantage point, could you see that he went in without buying a ticket? And he said, yeah, well, you could see the cashier's booth, which was out on the sidewalk. I really don't know for sure whether he bought a ticket. Now, either he did or didn't buy a ticket. So there's a conflict right there that's a problem. I can't remember. And he says, when I went back to the store, I can't remember the names of the two men from IBM that were there, but one of them closed up for me while I was gone. When I came back, the store was locked, and I said, I'm going to go check. Now, does that sound a little fishy to anybody besides me?
They closed his store?
They closed his store for him.
Yeah, they locked up his store for him. I've read the same interview, and that's preposterous. He knew Oswald. Brewer had seen Oswald before.
Right. Bob Kidd's coming.
As early as within the last 12 months.
Yeah. But I just thought that was so unusual that these IBM guys, you have a choice to hang out at the Carousel Club or a shoe store. Let's go to the shoe store. That'd be more fun, I think.
About IBM during that era as well. They worked in computers. They worked in the missile programs.
Right.
They worked in places like that.
So
I guess every duty.
Do you know if there was an IBM facility anywhere in Oak Cliff?
Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth is the first thing I think of, Frank.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just thought I'd plug the website because there's some gold on those interviews.
You got aerospace all over Dallas during that era. That's where IBM people would be looking.
Yeah.
Hey, David and Casey, this is Dan Storfer. A couple of things. I was wondering if it might be a good idea to try and come up with a couple of topics for each of these meetings where, you know, people could kind of prepare, you know, thoughts and questions, with the idea that there'd be a bit of a focus on topics of likely mutual interest.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of working on with each month changes a little bit differently. I know last month we had some key speakers that I'd like to eventually get it where it's on the website for the event page. That says, this is the topics we're going to cover for this meeting. And we'll eventually get there, but kind of right now we're in the infancy stage. I mean, it's only our third meeting, but it, trust me, hang in there with us and they will definitely be more, they'll be better put together. How about we say that?
Yeah.
And sometimes I know I try to get, different key speakers. And along with their topics, and sometimes just because personal lives happen, they have to back out the last minute, or sometimes when that happens, it's kind of hard to get somebody to kind of fill that spot. So last month went really kind of to the letter how I want it to go this month. We're still getting great information, and anytime we can gather our minds together and discuss things, it's always
no, it's great. It's great. I'm not in any sense being critical. But one of the things that occurred to me, you know, we're all kind of looking out in our own worlds, and the idea that, you know, we're all at some point, like it came up today, coming up with new discoveries. And I was just thinking about this because I'm still pondering this, because I've been kind of networking with a bunch of New Orleans. I live in New Orleans, and I'm networking with a bunch of New Orleans cops that were around in the 60s. Some of them are obviously not willing to talk about much, but yesterday this cop told me something that, you know, it's always when you hear something like this, you go, whoa, that's pretty wild. But he had stopped a car that was traveling mysteriously slowly, or slowly, and, you know, it was late at night, like 1 a.m, stopped this car and basically, you know, ID'd the people in the car. And he told me that, you know, and I'd heard this story, so I needed to verify it from the horse's mouth, from a friend of his, that it was Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. And I said, okay, that's an interesting one. And, you know, this guy, you know, longtime New Orleans, you know, cop, gave details, specific stuff, you know, because later on, obviously, he, you know, saw the assassination and recognized these people as being key players, and, you know, brought it to his boss, who was the head of the NOPD, and boss kind of said, leave it alone. You know, I was just thinking that one of the things is, like, there are these kind of new discoveries that pop up now and again, and sharing some of those might be of interest.
Yeah, let me throw something else in there, Dan. Starting in May or June after our spring conference, what we're going to do is we're going to have our live event. We're going to do basically – right now we're just doing one show a month, and it's live. We basically just kind of – sometimes we just kind of wean it. But starting in May or June, I'm hoping to have a definite – structure built into our meetings, and also we're going to actually start going to two events a month. One will be live like we're doing now, and then there's going to be a pre-recorded interview or presentation by a certain individual. So it won't be live, but what will happen is at the time of 1 o'clock Central Standard Time, the video will go live and you can view it on the website. You won't have to have a Zoom meeting code or anything. You just go there and see the new pre-recorded video. And as I can get people booked into that, then that's what we're going to start doing. So you'll have a pre-recorded event, which will be a strong topic of what they want to talk about, and maybe some of their new research you're working on. And then the 2 weeks later, you'll see the live event, or vice versa, live and then pre-recorded. But either way, I'm going to try to get it to where we can go to two shows a month that way.
Cool.
And it becomes bigger than how we might start doing, you know, more than just two. But right now I'm concentrating on one. We're in the MC stage, then we'll go to two, and we'll follow that format.
Great.
Your point is well taken, we would like to at least put one or two basic items out, like David was saying, to give us a little bit more structure so that we can sit back and say, okay, yeah, we're going to be talking about this particular point of view. We were, for the last couple of weeks, I know Brian has been working on this. We've been trying to get a hold of Sarah Peterson and Catania Zachary. They just finished a book called The Lone Star Speaks. And they would have been on today, but they have a book signing at a library or at a mall. And so that's why they can't be here today. But we're trying to get them to speak at the global conference. But if we could put out one or two items like that, which would take up probably about 10, 15, 20 minutes, it would give us a little bit more structure and a little bit more direction and maybe draw some other people in, like you said. So point well taken, and we are working on that. Thank you. And also keep reminding us of that, because I know all of us work here, and I'm sure you guys do too, so we're trying to put everything together. But point well taken. Thank you.
Brian wanted me to make mention, we are working on archiving the Dick Russell collection. There's about 56, I think there's over 50 boxes with probably 20 folders in each box that we're in the process of digitizing. They will be up on Baylor's website, and then eventually they will make it to ours as well. But we are still doing the archive process, and we're hoping to get to Gary's place again real soon so we can get some more stuff of his and get that put out online. And then anybody that, you know, would like to submit things, you know, documents, articles that you may be writing and you want to have a place to put them. Obviously, you know, Mary Farrell Foundation is a great place to go, but also we would like to reach out to everybody. If you'd like to submit something, we would love to put it up on the website and get people to point to that. And any information you want to put out there, we have a blog. We can do videos. So by all means, that's kind of where we're taking, where we started out with Project JFK years, decades ago, where we're at today with technology. We've got all kinds of vehicles to use, so we're jumping in every seat we can to drive to that. So, let's see, Brian, you want to add something to the to that? Hold on, your microphone's muted.
I said Katana looks like she's checked in, but I don't see her, so maybe she'll be with us here in a minute. She could share something from her book.
Okay, yeah, I admitted her in the room, and also a few other people that just because their names pop up, they may be in the audience, you know, seeing what we're doing. Their cameras may not be on, but they're actually at least close at hand. So,
okay.
You want to add something to that?
Oh, can I just add on that? I put it all in the chat, but Joe Marshall Smith smelled smoke. And he said this in the Texas Observer. I pasted that link in. But I can't find it right now. I've just been looking, and I've lost my patience, so it'll have to come up some point. But there's another interview, another document that I came across that is very rare. It's so rare, I can't even find it right now. So, and it basically states as well that Smith smelt smoke. And those are his own words, that when he came behind the picket fence when he arrived there, because Smith stood in front of the Texas School Book Depository, or close by that, and ran. He's seen in the background of the couch film. And when he ran over there, he said he smelled gun smoke. So.
Okay. Yeah, he was running down the, I guess that's what was known as the Elm Street Annex.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that was at street level. That wasn't 60, 70 feet up in the air, right?
No.
Right. I don't see how smoke would, you know, I've fired probably 10,000 rounds in my life, but I don't ever remember seeing smoke go lower than the barrel of a gun. It's usually going up unless there's a tornado or something, but usually goes up.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Sure, Joe.
Has anyone been in contact with anyone at Archives 2, and do they know for certain that a release is coming next month?
I haven't. Have you, Brian?
What basis do you think that there's a release coming next month?
I've been hearing April is when they're going to release. April is when they released it last year.
Well, April is when...
Or was it 2018?
2018, right.
Yeah,
but this is a different situation.
Yeah, this cycle is... April 26th is the deadline the archive is set for the agencies to notify the archivists if they intend to withhold any records. That would give them 6 months to kind of work it out. But I don't think there's any, I mean,
October's the date.
Right, October is the date, and I think NARA would prefer to have a rolling rollout. I guess that's why. So they want to do a rollout of the documents, not all at once. So there may be releases. If there are documents released, they will be after April 26th, probably. You know, they may be rolling them out if there are agencies that are willing to release them.
Hmm.
But that's a soft date. You know, that could slide. As opposed to 10/26, which is the hard date that the president established. Illegally, but.
There it is.
And that was Trump that established that, correct?
Yes. Right. Well, at the recommendation of the archivist, and that's what we're...
So between April 26th and October, we may be seeing releases?
Yeah, I mean, the intent that the letter, the correspondence from the archivist indicated a preference for doing rolling releases, not all at once because of staffing constraints. So that's why they set the date of April 26th.
All right, and the second corollary to that, has anyone heard anything about when Archives 2 will restore the JFK online database for their collection that will only give you the RIF information and not really the scan of any document? Because that's been down since September.
Really?
Wow.
Nothing? Okay. I would really love for that to be back. I mean, they have this Excel database, which they say contains all the numbers in the online database, but I would prefer to have the online database and see the RIF sheets rather than the Excel information.
Can you send me an email really quick just describing what the situation is? Because I'll just throw that in my letter that, you know, for some reason that they're not providing.
Yeah, what is your, Larry, what is your...
It's Larry at Schnaff, S-C-H-N-A-T as in Peter, F as in Frank, law.com. So schnafflaw.com.
What Malcolm told me is that he's actually waiting for the LBJ library to open up because apparently there's some serious McCone papers.
McCone? Well, LBJ library, that's just a wealth of information that's only... The surface of stuff has been released. It's like 1-3% of people's collections has been released.
Yeah. So there's supposed to be some really serious stuff in there. And, especially, he made me aware of a document that made mention of very important papers by John McCone and that were buried in there. Because from his side, it wasn't released, but Malcolm found out that it was also being held in the LBJ library. So.
I think it was last Sunday in the New York Times. Did anyone see it? Lady Bird Johnson, there's a book about her and her diaries coming out.
Yeah.
I think it came out this week.
What?
I'm somebody, I can't prove this, but I've always believed this, that Lady Bird Johnson did not start her diary on the day of the assassination. She wrote a book on her diaries. And that came out in 69 or 70 or something, I think, that she started her diary, speaking into an audio tape on the day of the assassination. That doesn't make sense to me. When would she have the time alone to herself to, and why would she think to start to do that on that day? I just have this idea that she was comfortable with doing that prior to the assassination, and I hope, you know, someday someone, I'll be proved right about that. I could be wrong, but it's just a feeling that I had that she started that before the assassination. But for some reason, her book, her first book written back in the 60s or late 60s or 70s, that she started a diary on the day of the assassination. That just seems like, you know, because you can see, you know, in films and video and then such, you know, where she generally was. And why would you have this time alone to start an audio diary? And another thing that might be interesting to some people, Benedict Cumberbatch is going to be in this movie called The Courier about Oleg Penkovsky, if people have known that name. And he was a spy within the Soviet Union for us, a spy who stayed in place and was executed during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
But just extraneous other bits that we also have to pay attention to.
Good information, Joe, and I'm glad that you could join us this month. We always like to hear from you.
Thanks.
Great information. That's the whole point of these things, is getting together and sharing information that normally we would have to wait until the conference in November, you know, before we could actually share things or back and forth emails, and that's just a, you know, two-sided conversation. So having a place to do it like this on the Proud of JFK Journey shows each month is a great place for us to get together and share ideas and have a meeting of the minds. So who's next that would like to say something?
Hi, I'm Katana Zachary. I just was able to join. I've already enjoyed what I've heard so far. I'm sorry I couldn't get here earlier, but I ran in as fast as I could.
Well, it's very nice to have you with us, Katana.
Well, I really love the idea that, and I like the idea that we can toss out a name or toss out a date and somebody and say, all right, anyone know anything about this? And you feel comfortable with the group that you're with. So, for example, I have a name I'll toss out. Anyone know anything about a man named Samuel Gilbert who may be connected to both Jack Ruby and General Walker?
Wow.
No, I don't know that name.
By any chance, do you have a mandate over you?
The other day, no, it's just, sorry, I live in Midland, Texas, and our connection is very unstable.
Oh.
Okay. So are some of the inhabitants, I hate to admit. don't repeat me on that.
I'm from California. I agree with you. I got the same problem.
Isn't this being recorded?
Yeah.
Hope not. The other day, our library, our county public library, was getting rid of old telephone books, and I walked in time to save Dallas 1960 through 1966. Because they, you know, they say, well, they're on the computer. And I explained, yeah, but that's not the same thing as having the books with all the advertisements and, you know, all of that. And she said, well, do you want them? I went, you bet. And so I walked out with these huge, big telephone books. But if anybody thinks I need to find out where so-and-so lives, just text me or email me and I'll see if I can help.
Okay. I've got something on Gilbert here in one of the documents. Shall I read it out loud?
Yeah.
Sure.
Go ahead, Bart.
Okay. Okay. Sorry, I just lost it. Okay, yeah. Ms. Stoller stated that she wanted to furnish information concerning a Samuel Gilbert, who resided at 4344 at Avondale, Dallas, Texas, until his death in 1964. She stated that Samuel Gilbert, who was the same approximate age as Jack Ruby, and Jack Ruby were close personal friends. She related that the Gilbert family and the Rubenstein family, Jack Ruby's parents, moved from Poland to the United States together. These families moved to New York and then to Chicago, with Samuel Gilbert and Jack Ruby eventually both living in Dallas, Texas. Ms. Stollett advised that she and her husband first met Samuel Gilbert in 1951. When they rented a house from him at 414 Lovers Lane, Dallas, Texas, beginning in 1960, her father, Edgar D. Box, and mother, Ruby C. Box, moved in with Gilbert at 434 Avondale and became his live-in housekeepers. The information that she's now providing was related to her by her mother and father, and to some extent sets forth what she personally observed when she visited Gilbert's residence. Jack Ruby came to Gilbert's residence numerous times between 1960 and 63, and their mother cooked dinner for them on many of those occasions. At one time, Gilbert wanted Jack Ruby to move in with him, but her mother objected because she did not want to take care of another individual. Miss Stollard related that Gilbert was a somewhat mysterious man who apparently owned quite a large amount of real estate. Gilbert had apparently been an aerial photographer during World War II and was quite proud of his service record. He had a photographic darkroom at his residence that contained numerous aerial photographs. He usually kept the darkroom locked. Gilbert had numerous influential friends, including H.L. Hunt, Dallas oil millionaire, Fred Florence, phonetic, and Russ Meyer, movie producer. She stated that Gilbert's residence at 434 Avondale was located two houses away from General Edwin Walker's home, located on Turtle Creek Boulevard. She advised that on the night that Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot at General Walker, her parents and some of the people in the neighborhood allegedly saw a man running through the alley behind General Walker's house after the shooting. Her parents were not sure, but they thought they saw a man run into Gilbert's driveway, and the possibility exists that this man could have hidden in Gilbert's photographic darkroom. In 1962, Gilbert started talking that people were out to get him, and Gilbert thought the mafia was following him. Gilbert was afraid to go out by himself and on several occasions paid a father, who was in his 70s at that time, $10 to ride shotgun with him. It was on one of those occasions that Gilbert and her father drove to H.L. Hunt's residence, located at White Rock Lane, Dallas, Texas, to deliver strawberries. Gilbert also mentioned that he had a friend by the name of Ferry Punetic in New Orleans. Gilbert went to New Orleans frequently prior to 1963. Miss Stollett advised that Ferry's name came up in the late Jim Garrison investigation. In May 62, Gilbert also allegedly said he was going to Cuba in that he was concerned with getting the prisoners out of Cuba after the Bay of Pigs invasion. Miss Stollett advised that she recalls seeing an Israeli and Cuban passport or visa at Gilbert's residence in May 62. Gilbert was allegedly very upset when he found out that Jack Ruby had shot Oswald, and when he heard the news, he just passed out. After that time, Gilbert spent a lot of his time trying to raise money for legal counsel for Jack Ruby, as well as money for jeeps for Cuba. Gilbert apparently lost all of his money within a short period of time after the assassination of JFK. Gilbert was hospitalized somewhat during January or Feb 1964, and he died at the Convalescence Center located across the street from Baylor Hospital on Gaston Avenue, Dallas, Texas. He allegedly had cut his wrist during the night. She is suspicious of his sudden death since he was an apparently influential man. Only six people attended his funeral, a closed casket ceremony, three of whom were members of her family. Her mother, who is now in her 80s and has had several strokes, resides at the Brookhaven Nursing Home, Farmers Branch, Texas, believed that Gilbert really did not die and believes that he went to Israel to get away from the people that supposedly were after him. Ms. Stollett stated that as far as she knows, Gilbert was never questioned by any investigators after the assassination of JFK, even though Gilbert considered Ruby his best friend. Edgar D. Box, Ms. Stollett's father, died several years ago. Ms. Stollett is separated from her present husband and currently is a part-time English instructor at Richland Community College, Dallas, Texas. I'll tell you what, I've got this document online. I'll paste the link in. I just got to swap it between computer, but I'll paste the link into Google Drive, and all you have to do is
click on that. That is all I've been able to find.
Sorry?
That was all I was able to find, too.
Okay.
He could very well be.
Tana, can you hear me?
Yes, Gary.
This is Gary. I have a pretty thick file on that, and if you'll holler at me at your leisure, I can give it to you. I've got the handwritten notes of Udo Specht, who was the FBI agent that interviewed Stollard. And that's Stollard with an A. It's not an O.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Katana, is that right? Am I pronouncing the name right?
Rhymes with banana, Katana.
Oh, Katana. This is Doug Campbell. Thank you for that. That's very, very interesting. I've made a study of Walker over the years, and that's a new name to me, too. That's really interesting.
Well, it sounds like he may be one of the very first mysterious deaths. Now, being Jewish, it doesn't strike me as odd that he was buried very quickly, because that happens in the Jewish religion. But I cannot find an obituary, and he was a well-known Dallasite. I cannot imagine why there doesn't seem to be an obituary in the Dallas papers.
Katana, Bill Simpich here. I see several hits for him on Mary Farrell. Was he involved in the banking or insurance industries?
Well, it depends.
Insurance, one time.
Yeah, there were three Samuel Gilberts in Dallas, and I think they're often confused. So I think insurance is closer, like Gary said.
Anyway, that article is it's number 124-10371-10116, and I sent a copy to our friend David Knight as well. So between me and Bart, you all should be able to get a copy of this document he just read. And there's a few more.
Right, and I did find in the phone book that he is listed not as an insurance agent, but as a photographer, which would explain the dark room and the aerial photography and all of that.
He's also in the Republic National Bank, his office.
Republic National Bank. Right, I pasted it in. It's in the window.
Can you see this?
Hold that up again a little bit.
Okay.
Yes.
That's him.
Wow. Where
did you find that, Gary?
I hunted it down.
Okay, just one.
He was a well-known as was the Fred Florence. He was a big executive with the Republican National Bank. They were best buddies, and obviously he was Gilbert was best buddies with Jack Ruby. And
right. Can you think of why would they if he committed suicide, would that be why they didn't put an obituary in the paper?
Well, I don't know. I don't remember whether I picked up an obituary or not. I've got his death certificate, and it doesn't mention anything like that.
Hmm. Okay. Well, it's odd timing that he died so shortly after he was so upset about Jack Ruby killing all.
Why, it's never happened in this case.
I know, never.
That was a joke.
It's sheer coincidence.
Yeah.
Another coincidence.
Well, Katana, I was just going to say I enjoyed your, I finally finished your book just the other day, and I enjoyed it very much and read it from cover to cover. And I recommend it to anybody that hasn't got it. You need to put that in your library because there's some stuff in there that I don't know how she and Sarah were able to find these folks, but it's well worth the read because it'll be one of those, wow, I never heard of this person before. How did they get a hold of that guy? Wow, that's interesting. So that's my two thumbs up for the book there.
Thank you. We owe Gary Shaw and Ed Petro a big hand too. They both helped us.
Katina, this is Larry Schnaff. We have an email exchange a couple of years ago.
Yes, I remember.
Book. Yeah. Can you relay the kinds of conversations you had with Forrest Lucy? We're trying to get hold of him. He was the last.
Listen, good luck on that. Yeah. He doesn't want to about anything he doesn't want to talk about. And so we had Gary. No, Ed Petro, I believe. No, I'm sorry. Phil Nelson had put us on to his name. And, of course, you can find him in the Warren Report.
Yeah.
And then we found an article in a newspaper run at one of the suburbs of Dallas where on one of the anniversaries of the death, he was talking about exactly what he wanted to talk about. He will not talk about the comments he made about that rifle and that it was unusually or exceptionally had an excessively dirty bore.
Right.
And so I'm guessing, knowing teachers, having been one, that particular day he made some comments that later he wished he had not said. And so I don't know if you'll ever get him to talk about that.
So who introduced you to him?
Phil Nelson gave us the name, and we just started tracking him down and finally found his phone number and just caught him out of the blue. And he told us, once I explained to him all we wanted to know about is what he had said that particular day, and he told us he would not talk about that. And then after we found the other article, I was shocked that he had spoken about anything at all. So
yeah,
it's that particular comment that he doesn't want to talk about.
Yeah, that was at a high school, ROTC, and so Russ Baker just told me that, you know, they actually got in touch with him and he shut down the moment he started, and Russ tried to ask him, you know, six different ways, and he just shut down because he's the last person in this, you know, he's the one that packed the rifle and sent it off to Washington.
Right. And Sarah and I think it might be significant that for some reason he ends up in San Angelo, Texas, West Texas, where there is a base and where military intelligence, who has gone to the language school in California, are often sent before they are actually assigned to their duties. So maybe it's not a coincidence that he was doing his student teaching in San Angelo, Texas.
Hmm. And did you record your conversation with him or just take notes? How did you do that?
We called him while we were driving in the car, and I was writing as fast as I could write while Sarah drove and have a recording device with us.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, Katana, if you'd spoken with any of the members of the family of Cliff Chastain or the barber in Irving or the Irving police chief at one time and Detective Paul Barger.
No, sir. I know exactly who you're talking about, but those were a group of people that we didn't end up getting a chance to talk to.
Yeah, I'm looking for their family members as we speak. Thank you.
Oh, I forgot to mention. Completely forgot to mention. I've been in contact with Nellie Darnell. She is Jimmy Darnell's daughter. And she sent me a document that I posted online about a week ago. And the document is actually, I think, written in 64, where Jimmy Darnell basically summarizes his experiences of that day. There isn't a lot from on Darnell with regards to statements as such. I mean, he spoke to Richard E. Sprague in 68, and the FBI interviewed him about, I don't know, 10 days after the event. So it was kind of cool to get a 20-page document. I did an interview with her about 2 and a bit years ago, which I still have to transcribe. But she then all of a sudden out of the blue contacted me about a month ago, and she said, I found Jimmy Darnell, her dad's notes. And I was like, do you want them? And I was like, yeah, of course. So she sent me the document about 2 weeks ago. And it's in a PDF format. It's on my website if you go to the CAM section and hit James Darnell, James Glenn Darnell, and it's on the bottom of the page. There's a link to the I only put 3 pages up, but there's a link to the entire document as well. So it's a very good read, actually. About, you know, it doesn't mention anything about the bit that I'm actually completely focused on for the last 7-8 years already, but just overall the generic bits. And puts things in perspective as well, because on a Monday he went to an event of, I think, the school children or something like that, completely non-related to the JFK assassination and such. But first he's part of this whole thing for 3 days, right in the midst of it all, and then on the Monday he's just doing the completely, well, basically a non-event as such of at a school to film it as such. But
you mean...
Sorry?
Do you mean the Monday right after the assassination?
Yeah, yeah. He just did some... Well, that's basically the job, you know. They get sent out. That's how it worked as such. I mean, I've also got the notes of the 3 days that he was working on the 22nd to the 24th, how many feet of film was shot and on what and where. And, you know, that's pretty detailed as such. So, yeah. I thought I'd make a mention of that.
Well, what surprised me was I remember being a school child that day. Most schools closed for the president's funeral that day. What school would have been open?
I don't know. That doesn't. There's no mention of that. Not that I know of. Let me just have a look.
Art, I'm going to send you a memo I got from a guy named Ronnie Palliger, who says he's got some Darnell footage. I haven't known what to do with it, and he lives in Marina Del Rey. And I'll give you his phone number and everything.
Oh, I know who he's talking about.
Oh, okay. So you've already run that line of country?
Yeah, and he's basically tried to contact several other people beforehand, and I knew about it beforehand, and then he tried to contact me.
But you don't think he's got anything, I take it?
I wouldn't say that, but I'm also accusing him of messing around. There's something about it that just doesn't rhyme. And I can't really talk about it. But what I do know is that, you know, he's been to Oliver Stone and he's been to the ARC and they all declined. And so it's something, this guy is reaching out. He's a collector. He's a really good collector, I've been told. He's got really rare things, not just JFK, but moon landings, you name it, you know, anything from the 60s or the 70s and anything that's really rare. He's got, and he probably has a first generation copy of the Darnell film. Look, I'll tell you this right away. I don't think either of the Weekman or the Darnell film is going to show Prayer Man in all its glory. It will need artificial intelligence to enhance the film. That's the main thing. You will not. And it's I've got the Weekman in 5K format, and it's a newsreel print copy, which isn't the greatest quality, but it's better than anything else that's online. And the issue is that almost everything is from, say, from Elms, when the car stops, or just before that, Houston to Elm, that stretch, all of it is practically blurred. And the second swerve of the camera, basically when they're about to get, just before he gets out, the car starts running down, there is probably one frame that can be worked with. And Richard E. Sprague saw that as well. Richard E. Sprague had his copy that he got from Fox Metrotone. He had a professional photographer. He cut the film. So he cut the 16 millimeter copy that he had, and he had the frames reproduced on 5x4 negs. And those negs are at NARA, and a pal of mine had them, found them, which was a sheer coincidence, and he basically had those images enhanced by 5x4. And they are, thus far, the best quality images that I'm after of Prayer Man as such. It's better than the 5K version. Something happened in the copying process between whatever copy they have and the copy that went on the newsreel print. I'm not surprised, because back then, you know, it was a process of making copies fast and getting them out as quickly as you can. So, and you know, it was just done by hand as such. So, you know, there's a tremendous loss of quality as such. The same thing with the Darnell.
I wanted to tell Katana that the Sam Gilbert information's on the John Armstrong research notebooks. It's 8-4. You could look in there. John's got.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, Bart, about the Texas Book Depository. I asked the curator there to, just give us the slide, you know, because it should be public.
They won't.
And somebody should take them to court, I think. A lot of the stuff they've got in there is public documents.
They hide behind NBC.
Yeah, I know. I know they do. They hide behind NBC, but they've got a lot of public documents. They've taken a lot of public money. They should be treated as a public enterprise. I'm there right now. I'm paying them money for videos I don't feel like I should have to pay them for. You know,
are these the videos of the, what'd you call them? Those interviews they're doing?
Yeah, the interviews. Yeah. I'm not.
Like $10 a throw.
Yeah, it's not a terrible amount of money. $5 a transcript, $10 a throw for video.
Yeah.
So I recommend people, if you want good information on these people, it's just sitting there, and they can get it to you by email in a few days.
Yeah, I know.
I'm Kent Biffle, who I'm going to present on next month. Biffle did an interview with them in 1993. But hundreds of people have done interviews. I think Joe Backus or other people on this call have probably done interviews with them.
Who?
Bill, how come they weren't identified as assassination records?
Well, they should be. As far as I'm concerned, this is criminal, the enterprise they're running over.
Maybe we should add that to the letter.
I think we should. This stuff is public documents. Now, the one thing I will say for them is they did it under their own labor, but they've been heavily subsidized by public funds, and they've been given public documents. It's public, and they've been privatizing it, and it's a terrible thing.
I've been investigating for the last 4 or 5 years where the Darnell film is. I still know one source, really good source, that has it, which I'm not going to divulge, but I hope to get there one day. And basically what it means is that the films apparently were moved to New York really quickly after the original Weekman and Darnell films, as legend says. What I found out really funny, and this Dennis Morissette told me about this about 2 years ago, and he said, have a look at this footage, because what it was is that about 3-4 years ago, I found out, I saw a video of Gary Mack and Gary Mack for on NBC5, and he was like, and we're going into the bowels of NBC5, blah, blah, blah. And they go down in the basement, and they're just in some room, and I'm not kidding you. This is not temperature controlled whatsoever, and it's just a cardboard box on a shelf. And there's all these reels of films and goes, yeah, this is all the JFK assassination footage, blah, blah, blah. So I started to contact Brian Hawker, is his name, who's the vice president of NBC5. And at the same time, I also found out that they were getting rid of all the reels that were in the basement and they were giving them to UNT. And I was like, awesome. We're going to get all this stuff digitized and we're going to be able to view this on YouTube. Fat chance. Only the news articles and all that stuff, all that footage, that's at UNT. And then all of a sudden, Dennis Morissette contacts me and goes, have you seen this? And he shows me, and it's Jimmy Donnell going through the reel. And I found that B-roll footage, and there's about three or four items where they're basically using this film. But then I saw something that was completely wrong with it. And it's not Donnell's fault. It's basically the... Well, nobody knew, obviously. Donnell is looking at the Wiedemann film. He doesn't look at his film. It's the Wiedemann film. When Wiedemann got out of the car, he ran on the right side, on the northern side of Elm Street, up towards the knoll and started filming the Hesters and so forth. When Donnell got out, he went over the grass on the left-hand side, the south side of Elm Street. He films the press bus going past, and then basically makes his way up the stairs with Roger Craig as such. So Donnell wasn't even clocking the fact that he was actually looking at the wrong film. He was even going, this is when I get out of the car, this is where I run, this, that, and the other. He ran on the other side of Elm Street as such. So I'm like, how the hell can that be? And this is 2006, approximately, around that time. Because when Gary Mack was approached for Death in Dealey Plaza, they had to get the film on Wiedemann's film from UCLA because they didn't know anyone else who had that film. And Mac used to work for WBAPE, which became KXAS after that and then became NBC5. So I'm writing this massive article. This is already 3-4 years in draft mode. Gary Mack has been heavily involved with the transfer of these films. And I got, at some point, got so annoyed because I basically was sent round and round and round by Brian Hawker, by the Sixth Floor Museum, by UNT, and it just kept going. I'm going, hold on a minute. You lot have your hands on these films, and you're not coming clear with where these actually went to. And Gary Mack, at that point, had just passed away. And... it's just really frustrating because someone has a really good collection of films from KXAS in his possession. You know, that's basically all the NBC footage. And by the way, Larry, there's one more thing you can probably inquire about when you talk to the JFK Library stuff. Apparently, the JFK Library is supposed to have film reels of NBC about everything that was filmed that day. So if you are in contact with the JFK Library, please ask them if they have it.
Interesting.
That's my story.
I want to make a point here, and I think it's a very interesting point, and maybe take up Katana's search for a library and get material that was being confiscated. Over the last probably at least a year, David, Brian, and myself have been in contact with several archivists and libraries, especially around Dallas, Texas. But not only that, we are finding out, as well as most of you guys, that these libraries and the archivists or librarians, whatever you want to call them, are making room for new material that's coming in, and they're confiscating a lot of the book, the documents, and the materials that they have put into their library, maybe in the government documents, government stacks, and they're getting rid of those. And we are now in the process of trying to get a hold of a lot of these archivists to gather that information before they actually throw it out or give it back to whoever gave it to them. But at the same time, a lot of that material is going by the wayside. And I just wanted to point that out. That's one of those things where we thought for a long time and maybe forever that they would be there, but they're not going to be there. They're making room for, God forbid, I'd hate to say Xboxes and all the other stuff that the kids got in there.
Well, the thing that I'll kind of throw something in here, it seems, I know that they just did a revamp of the Truman Library here in the KC metro area. And we're just a little south of that, but they basically came on the news and said, you know, we get a lot of donations of materials, and then we have to sit there. It takes about 11 and a half hours to go through one box of materials to archive it. And some of the stuff that we get, we don't find that it has any importance, so we just toss that part out or we give it back to them. And that is so disheartening to researchers like us, because the problem with that is if you go to some websites or some libraries or institutions and you want to look at something, you're told a few things. Either number one, we have it in boxes. You'll have to make a request and then show up, or you'll get told, well, there's certain things that we can't show you because it's copyrighted, or we don't know what we can do with it if we can show it to you. So we're in the process of getting things that some institutions and libraries that have in their collections, but they've been sitting on it for years and they don't know what the hell to do with it. At projectjfk.com, I don't care if it's one piece of paper, one film, one page of notes, or if it's, you know, tens of thousands of documents, photographs, videos. We're putting it out there so that way, you know, no matter who it is, whether it's a seasoned researcher, whether it's a junior high school, or college student, they go to our website, they find things that they can't find other places to write their reports on, because if we don't make this stuff available and make it, and that's another thing, we don't charge for any of this. We do it, you know, I'm not going to say we do it out of the goodness of our hearts. We do it because, hey, let's take a look at what we get. But the point is if we have it to where you can't get a hold of the information, you have to travel for it, or you have to pay a fee to get a hold of that information, the younger generation, which are the ones we want to get involved in with this, because my generation, Casey's generation, Gary Shaw's, anybody else's generation, we need to get the new researchers, the younger generation involved in this to carry this on. If we don't do that, it's going to end up dying with us.
So let me ask you a question, David. Do you know the terms of the donations? Or is there a standard term of the donation, other which what kind of discretion the library has?
Gary can answer that. Sorry to interrupt. Gary can answer that. He put some of his stuff down there and at Baylor. Gary, do they have a restriction of how long they're going to keep it?
They never mentioned any restriction. What they told me is possibly down the way, if they ran out of room or it wasn't doing anything for them, they would give it to somebody else.
So is that in writing?
I think it is. I've got a file on it, and that's been several years ago, and a different man was running that, a guy named Dan Rogers.
Yeah.
I believe so,
Bill Simmons, I'm thinking that given that notice that David has been given, that maybe ARC or some organization should send a letter to each of the repositories, advising them that if they should not destroy the records and public records, and to cease and desist, and to advise the recipient of any attempts to do that, so that we could set up a possibility of going for a preliminary injunction.
I think that's a good idea.
Well, I think it's a great idea, but I also would almost say, like, go do what the FBI did or has been doing all for decades. Find somebody who can act as an informant and offer him cash if something happens in the way that they think. If they're going to trash it as such.
I'm trying to be serious here about this is a serious problem, because I know I have that problem just with environmental stuff, that the states are starting to destroy records. And then when you go for a FOIA request, there's no records. So
Gary, what you want to do is pay attention to the Federal Register, and you want to, if you're talking about presidential libraries, you want to start paying attention to the Federal Register, and they'll put in, and the terminology is retention schedules.
Right.
So you have to check the Federal Register. Now, there should be like some public commentary period if they're planning to let go of things.
But no, we're talking about, I'll just give an example. We're talking about private libraries, or presumably, are they, these are state universities?
Right. Yeah, some are, yeah.
So, Gary, can you try to dig up the copy of whatever agreement? I don't know, was it a deed of gift that you, is that how it's structured?
Probably.
Yeah, probably so. I can't remember because it was so many years ago. And I quit putting things down there after he quit because nobody was interested. Yeah.
But we need to, like, put them on notice that if they're going to start destroying things, they have to give someone notice, whether it's the Project JFK or ARC or whoever, and at the risk of, I mean, I just want to make them feel that they can't just, they have a lot of things they could destroy, right? They're not going to destroy these JFK-related stuff, or else they're going to get sued.
Oh, you know what? I'll tell you one thing. This is one of the things that is prevalent of Malcolm's collection. And obviously, Malcolm has done a lot of research in many different corners of all the subjects that are rife in this whole thing. But he's also been looking for documents that have disappeared, especially like FBI, and so forth. So if people have a moratorium on something like, we'll keep the documents for 25 years, and they are perfectly entitled, basically, to destroy all this stuff.
Right.
And this is what happened, especially with the FBI and the agency as well. And just to say, like, you know, oh, they hide underneath that moratorium or some sort.
Joseph is right. I mean, I was one of my prior jobs. I was in charge of record retention. And so corporations have record retention positions. But this is libraries that are given gifts of documents. And there is at least some sort of contractual, there's got to be some contractual privity bill between the donor and the donee, in this case, the library, before they destroy the records. But I think just an across the bow, you know what universities you're dealing with. Obviously, when you start getting into like the Dallas, you know, the state run libraries, it's a whole separate story. But with these universities, I think if Gary can dig up the form, or if anyone else has donated materials, try to dig up your form. Let's see what the terms are. I think that they're probably silent on this issue, Gary. They probably just said, you know, we may return it, but they didn't say anything about destroying stuff, right?
Right.
So that would be, I think, a violation of the terms of your deed of gift. But
Dick Russell
put a warning, shot across the bow.
Dick Russell, you know, put his stuff down there. So did John Armstrong. And so we might approach both of those and see what kind of agreement they had.
Yeah, maybe we write a letter on behalf. So, Dave, do you know how many collections that we are concerned about?
Well, I don't know if I would say – obviously we're concerned about all the collections. But here's the thing. The number, I was talking to Bristol Plant in our five-hour conversation the other night, and we were speaking about the fact of when people give these – collections, whether they are still alive or after they pass on, and their collections go to, you know, private or, you know, public entities, you know, the point of it is before something happens and you're still in your sound mind and body, what I would like to get people to do, and this is not just, you know, like Gary Shaw, like, you know, Dick Russell, like us, you know, no matter how big your collection is important. There may be something in your collection that has a significant value. Everything's got a significant value to someone, somewhere in this research. So by not having something in plan, okay, it's just like the fact that you get a will made up. You have a DNR. You know that you want your stuff to happen a certain way you want it to happen. Put that in writing, make it a legal document. Larry, I'm sure you could probably, you know, interject into the fact of how to do this to where that way the wishes are carried out by that researcher. And I kind of go back to,
I wasn't there when Jim Morris passed away, but I know I've heard stories about how the fact of, you know, basically when he passed, it was a free for all, just take what you want.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, his repository in his home, I'm sure was a vast, you know, researcher's dream to be able to go through and find out what he had. And unfortunately, because of how stuff has been spread all across the United States, and all over Texas, we don't know exactly what he had. I mean, his collection is just, it's bits
right.
and pieces everywhere. And
but
some
have,
people may not ever tell us what they have.
There are two issues. One is going forward. I think it's a great idea. People should think about not using libraries and maybe going to like you or, you know, who's ever committed to digitizing these materials. But it's the stuff that's already been donated that's potentially at risk of being destroyed.
Right.
That's the pressing issue right now. Because we can make arrangements with people to donate going forward, but this stuff, if it's destroyed, it's gone.
Yeah.
So we need
to
focus.
The other thing is some of these, like I said earlier, some of these institutions that I've spoken to, I won't name which ones, but I'm not here on the thing, but I will say, you know, they say, well, there's certain things that are significant value, and there's only so much space that we have online to put things. And there's only so much space that we have, you know, physically where we can hold something. Okay, it's been donated, and I know that archiving and digitizing has not been around for, you know, 20, 30 years to the fact of where we're at today, but you can archive and digitize collections a whole lot easier and a whole lot faster and cheaper than what you could back in the day. So, you know, if they're going to have it, they need to put it out where people can consume it and go through it. But unfortunately, because of different strongholds that they feel that they have, some stuff they can't, you know, they can't make available.
So, you know what? You may want to consider contacting Dick Russell, Armstrong, whoever you know has made donations, and ask them if they want to reconsider donating stuff to you or whoever, because those donations are at risk now.
Yeah.
Now I know some places they put things off like off-site storage,
mm-hmm.
Which is even worse because a lot of times there's loss of controls, there's poor storage conditions. But there's a couple of things we need to take proactive measures to protect what's there now.
Right.
So either these repositories have to be put on notice that their donors are concerned about the fact that they are now, you know, they've heard that they may be destroying stuff. The donors, someone could, you know, if you can get the donors together, we can draft a letter to put them on notice to preserve them. Or if they no longer want them, they no longer have the space, they should then direct or basically give the materials to whoever the donor identifies as another repository.
Right.
Right.
So you're basically talking about a legal document, probably overseen by maybe you, Larry, and maybe Bill.
Initially, what we need is just, well, first of all, I think a letter would be sufficient at this point. I mean, there was a deed of gift, gift of deed, presumably, but we don't know what the terms and conditions of those are. We need to see what those are. But presumably, Bill, I think you can always take back the donation if you think that your materials are at risk.
That's right.
You know, I mean, it's unconditional, but well, I don't know. But anyway, yes, I would think a letter written on behalf of the donor. So it could be Dick Russell, it could be Armstrong, it could be Gary, whoever, indicating that they're writing on behalf of the donor. They, you know, the materials were donated. They now understand that there's a possibility that these materials may be destroyed because of storage constraints. And therefore, either they are to be notified before such materials are destroyed, number one. Number two, they may decide that they just want them to be directed to another repository that they feel is safe.
Larry, do you want, like for Dick Russell, I'm sure Dick would not want all those boxes of his documents destroyed. He still has stuff at his home in L.A. that we haven't seen yet. But as far as, is it just a verbal request that he says, yeah, I don't want that university to have my stuff anymore because they've sat on it for 10 years.
I think it's got to be a letter because you want to put them on notice.
Okay. Yeah, you
anything in writing, they're going to say they lost it and, you know.
Okay.
This is a serious issue if this is what you're being told, you know.
So if we talk to Dick Russell soon, do we need to get him in contact with you, or should we, how do you want to do that?
Let me talk to Bill, and, you know, I don't know if it would be better to have a California lawyer. He's in California, but he is a Baylor.
Right. Yeah.
What about Penn Jones' stuff? Because that's at Baylor as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
It's a whole library.
Identify the collections at risk.
Let me interrupt you, please. Larry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. This is a paragraph in my gift receipt from Baylor. When the library accepts a gift, it becomes the property of Baylor University, which reserves the right to determine whether the gift will be retained, where it will be located, and how it will be cataloged and circulated. That's basically what we're looking at here, so we really need to follow up on that.
Yeah.
I've got some stuff down there that are original to the Roscoe White thing, the original material that was found, and I put it down there because they had the ability to preserve it, archive it.
Yeah.
And it was fading fast.
So I would say that the letter would also identify these materials as historically significant. I mean, they haven't gone through that effort. I don't want them to decide what's historically significant. Bill, do you think what I don't want to do is start getting into practice of law in a different state I'm not admitted in? Although I guess we could probably write the letter for example, we could write a letter for Gary to sign. I mean, Gary's the donor. I mean, it's more effective of a lawyer sending it, but still, we could ghostwrite a letter for Gary to send to Baylor, you know, with those kinds of instructions. Or do you think we should get a Texas lawyer to?
I think we should look for a Texas lawyer. I think it would be a good idea.
Brad Keziah would be glad to do that, I'm sure.
That's just who I was thinking of. That's right.
See, guys, here's something I want to throw in there real quick. And just what Gary just read in that paragraph. The problem with this is when you get into private or, you know, institutions, places that, you know, take your collection that you're gifting to them, you know, in black and white, you just read it, it becomes our property. We make the decision. Well, the problem with that is, okay, they're making the decisions, like what Larry said, of what they decided they're going to keep, what they're not going to keep. The thing that the three of us guys over here at Prodigy FK is it's your materials. Okay, we will digitize it if you want us to hold certain parts of that collection and, of course, obviously, room constraints, storage constraints. You know, we don't have a problem doing that. It's the fact that it's still – that's the one thing I would never write in a contract. We're taking it on behalf of holding on to it so that way we can archive it, digitize it, and make it available. But the moment you say that we're taking possession of your collection and it's our property – that's the part that I have the problem.
Yeah, but I would argue that gift, the intent was that they were going to preserve the records, and they could give it to someone else. They had the discretion to decide how to characterize it, where to store it, but there's nothing in there about destroying it.
Right.
But also, if they decide they're not going to store it any longer, they need to give written notice. Whether it's by certified mail, not just email. Emails don't get delivered. Sometimes the mail don't get delivered, right. But certified mail.
No, you send a certified mail, and basically what you say is, these are my explicit instructions. These were not mentioned, you know, and then basically, if you do not agree with these provisions, then I'm asking that you return these either to me or to another place. I mean, basically, Gary, for example, gave materials under the assumption that they were going to be safely preserved. It wasn't mentioned expressly, but why else would Gary give them to a library?
Right. Well, right? Here's now, the other thing we run into, Larry, is the fact of Jack White, his collection is down there at Baylor as well. Now, Jack passed away. Don't know whether any provisions were written in the donation receipt that states the fact of, okay, what about the next of kin?
I'm sure theirs have rights.
Jack White has Wiegman slides.
Yeah. So, look, the idea is you send a letter, forget about, you know, legalities at this point. You put them on notice. I mean, look, I'm sorry, I'm an aggressive New York lawyer, okay? So, but I'm saying that you basically give them a scary letter. And then they can decide, you know what, I'm afraid that Gary's going to sue me. So I'm going to then, here, take your records back. You find someone who's an heir to, who is it?
Jeff White.
Jeff White. Say, I'm the heir. I have, you know, I'm the legal heir to all his materials. I know he gave this this. I understand, you know, he gave this to you for this purpose. If you're going to destroy these records, this is against the terms of the gift, my father's wishes. And, you know, I basically he has the right to enforce.
Right. And, well, I know that, you know, we obviously we didn't have any problem getting Dick Russell's collection given to us, digitized, and then, of course, we're sending the records back along with the hard drives that was provided by Baylor, which, you know, hey, great for that. You know, but I know that it did take a little bit of time to get it to us just because of people wanting to look at the collection. And that's fine. It's just the fact that, you know, once we get done with our part of the project and we ship that back, then again, you know, that collection is still remaining in Baylor's, you know, in their archives. It's still in their property.
Right.
But that's what I'm saying is even if we can't retain the originals, just because of either they've been donated to somebody else prior to us or, you know, the researcher wants their original back, they just want to have us as a digitizer and an archivist and to put it online for them. That's where we're at with it. It's not like the one thing that I stress to a lot of people that I talk to, they're like, well, I have this or I have audio interviews with somebody. That's great, but that's your property. We'll take care of digitizing and making the archives available. But, you know, you decide what you want to do with it. Do you want it back? Do you want us to hang on to it? Obviously, anything that comes to us, there's only two options. Either we give it back to that researcher or the institution that happens to give it to us.
The letter could also say that Gary is requesting that they consign the documents to you for the purpose of digitizing, and they'll return them back when they're finished.
Sure.
You then take temporary possession. You become a consignment, right?
Yeah.
You take temporary possession and you return it. So there's a range of requests or demands that could be made.
Right.
Depending on, I would first call the archivist up and say that, you know, you're on behalf of Gary and there's a concern about this. So we would, you know, Gary has asked us to talk to you. If necessary, if they need to see something in writing, I always believe in doing a conversation first. You've had a 5-hour conversation already, but yeah. Basically say that because of what your conversation with Baylor, that because of what they told you, Gary is now requesting that you be able that they consign the materials for you for a certain period of time to allow you to digitalize them, and then you'll return them. They're probably going to want to have all kinds of paperwork about releasing them from liability, blah blah blah. But that would be one option as mm-hmm. opposed to the real nasty letter. If they refuse to do that, then the nasty letter comes.
Right, and I just want to put this out because, you know, obviously I'm not, you know, downgrading anybody or, you know, starting shit. But the point is with Baylor right now and with Mary Goolsby that's down there at Baylor, who's the lady that we've been working with, she's been nothing but helpful.
Yeah.
And she's been really great with, you know, getting the materials to us and talking about other collections that we want to work with her on. So right now, like I say, I have, you know, myself, Brian, and Casey, we have no problem with Baylor University. I just want to put that out there in case somebody goes, hey, the guys at Project JFK was talking shit on you. No, we're not. We're just stating the fact that, you know, anything that, you know, may not, it's not Baylor, but it may be other institutions that are out there. We just want to make sure that, number one, we can get the materials or they can get the materials to digitize and make available. Number two, that destroying documents and parts of collections don't happen. And number three is if you run out of room, look at us to take possession of these collections, whether it's on a temporary basis or a permanent basis, to do the archiving and to get that out there for the research.
Yeah, so David, I would say that, you know, we should get the word out to people who have donated to whatever institutions they've donated to, and see if they'll designate you as their representative to have this conversation and see mm-hmm. where it goes. And if it doesn't go well, the conversation doesn't go well, then there's a second letter that has to be. But basically, clearly, you know, I mean, the idea, again, is that you are going to be given a consignment of the material so you can do this specific task, and then you return it. And I know she's not a bad person. you know, and they don't have, they don't know that, they don't know what they have a lot of times, and they need to be put on notice that also what they have is significantly historic.
Right. Well, it's just like, I mean, we get questions all the time. Do you know what happened to so-and-so stuff? Did they donate it? Did a family member take it? What happened, especially after a death? Even before that, it's like, you know what they're planning on doing with their collection? Are you guys going to, you know, help out in this aspect of archiving and digitizing? So we get asked those questions. So, you know, it's nice to, I'm sure there's many collections out there that we don't know just where the hell they're at. So you kind of have to go back and, okay, who was your big researchers that would have had huge collections and silos of information, and reach out to those people first and go, hey, you know, where's the stuff go to, or where's it planning on going to? And just in case, you know, here we are, you know, we're in the archiving business as well. I don't call it a business, but we're in the archiving circle as well, and we're more than happy to, you know, take those and archive the collections.
And as Brooke said, I mean, we're just again emphasizing that you're working on behalf of the donor.
Yeah.
So, you know, it looks like, based on what Gary got, it's a pretty very small, you know, it's not a comprehensive agreement, and there's lots of terms that are left unexpressed.
Sure.
So just because there's like a couple of paragraphs, I mean, you know, there's lots of conditions that have not been dealt with in that little agreement that you got. So just because it says this doesn't mean there's other issues that haven't been addressed. So,
well, the main thing is we're looking out for the researchers. Yes. And their hard work. I mean, they've donated their life. They've made, you know, I know, hell, I've got an ex-wife, soon to be, 30 plus years that I've been into it. You know, I don't want my collection of stuff to just, you know, get tossed out at the Goodwill store, or have an estate sale and it's all gone. You know, I have it where I know where it's going to go and what's going to happen with it, just like Brian and Casey's stuff.
And so, we're, you know, we're all at a certain age when things happen. And so if you have materials, you want to make sure your will or whatever thing that you've written up about the disposition of your, you know, what happens to your assets. And if it could just be simply an agreement with your wife or your husband, you know, what's going to happen to it stuff. But Bill, there's questions about whether your yawn is going to be recorded.
It's not. I'm on the edge of my seat with all this stuff. I love it.
You know, they say that yawning actually creates more oxygen to the brain, so you help pay, you know, it makes you pay attention a lot better. So we'll give Bill a kudos for, you know, staying awake and getting more oxygen to his brain.
The takeaway is that anyone that knows, either anyone that has stuff or knows people, like I see there on the chat thing, there's talk about William Manchester and there's David Lifton. I think the word needs to be spread that, you know, if you're contemplating or you have donated, you need to be concerned about this. This is happening across the country. People are running out of space and they're destroying stuff. It happens at all levels.
And another thing to interject on that, Larry, it's not the fact that, yes, they have the collections, you know, physical collections in a storage unit. Floods happen. Fires.
Yes.
Thefts happen.
Fires.
When these things get put in there, you know, you want to make sure that at least there's a digitized backup, you know, of your documents, of your collection, because at least that way, if something, you know, God forbid, does happen to that collection, at least you've got that digital backup that, you know, is able to be cared for and made available.
Yep. So, you know, maybe at some point we need to do a podcast that goes out to the world, the donors, but anyway, but all about gifting and deeding and that sort of stuff, but don't want to belabor the point more, but I think we raised an important issue today.
Yeah.
And thank you for giving us the heads up, because that is a serious problem.
Right.
You know, real quick story before I go and get my last COVID shot here. Brian and I were trying to finish up our book on Ed Hoffman and back in the early 2000s. I asked Brian, I said, can we use your copy of the Warren Commission documents and hearings? And he says, well, he says, there at KU, I've never been to the University of Kansas to actually get these documents. I said, well, let's go up there and check them out. So he goes up there and he gives them information that he would like to see the Warren Commission documents and hearings, the 26 volumes. And this is early 2000. And so they said, well, we know we have them, but we're not sure where they're at. So it took them a day to find the documents. And I think Brian basically told me that they were still in the original plastic that was sent to them back in 70 or 64, 65, 66. And
yeah,
he was the first person to get them.
Yeah, they hadn't been unwrapped yet, and the kids didn't even know where it was. Well, Baylor told us, or Mary told us the other day, that they had four or five full, complete copies in A1 condition of the Warren of all 26 volumes, and then she realized that she spoke too soon, and she said, well, we're going to have to give those back because we're running out of space. We're going to have to give them back to the original donor. So that was
Let me put this out. If anybody happens to have an extra set of the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission, we would love to have a physical collection in our archives. So if anybody wants to donate a set of the Warren Commission Report 26 volume set, Project JFK would be more than happy to house that set and preserve it. So I'm just throwing that out there. If anybody happens
to have... You're not a 503 yet, right?
No, not yet. No, not yet.
So the word donate is in quotes.
Right, exactly. You're gifting it to us to hold on for you.
Right.
So there we go. But don't think that we're not going to look through that shit, because we are. We're going to look through it.
I bought a clean copy a couple of years ago from a library. Again, a public library. They're making room, right? And they just got rid of their 20. They put them on eBay and bought them. Same thing with the HSCA.
Yeah.
Ian Griggs bought his copy of James Tate, because Tate bought two sets, and Griggs put the copies in a golf club bag to take back in the plane to take back to England. I kid you not. He told me this story twice. He says it's the only way for me to take it with me, so I could put it in a golf club bag. It's stuck all 26 books.
So he threw out his clubs?
Yeah.
I remember hearing Ian say that. I remember him telling me that. Yes.
I guess he was a real duffer.
Very good. Guys, I got to take you out. It's a good session. I got to go get my last COVID shot. So, guys, take care. Stay healthy.
Good luck. It's usually, hopefully you won't get any flu symptoms.
Hey, I'll get that flash drive finished, and you sort of pick it up next time. Okay, good. All right, well, hey, I'm still here. I know we've gone over our hour and a half mark, but does anybody else have anything they want to talk about?
Hey, this is Doug Campbell again. I just want to say how much I've enjoyed it. I'm about to have to head out. This has been great. Thank you for the invite. And I would love to get one of you guys, David or Casey or Brian, on Quick Hits, the Quick Hits podcast for a few minutes coming up in April to get the word out about this, because this is a great idea. I love it.
Yeah, we would love to. We'd love to come on. One of us would be more than happy to, come on the podcast and tell everybody what we're doing and the conference coming up and our monthly meetings that we have. So, absolutely, Doug.
Right, let's set it up, dude.
Cool.
This is one this is a benefit of not having an agenda, by the way.
Well, now here's the other thing, and I'm just going to throw this out there for everybody still here. You can reach either Brian, me, or Casey. We've got one group email, and I usually get the emails, and I forward them to, each other. ProjectJFK@yahoo.com is our main email address. And then if you want to reach out to me personally, you can also you can give me a phone call. My number is 913-980-JFK1.
Cool. We'll get Mr. Casey there. He'll be a return guest. He joined me on the Dallas action back in 2014, I think.
You got it, buddy.
Yeah, buddy. So we'll do that, man. We'll get the word out about this stuff. Absolutely.
Great.
And hopefully I'll be able to join you guys next time, too.
That'll work. Well, like I say, we'll send the email out. I'm going to try to get the Eventbrite deal set up probably Monday or Tuesday. And you'll be able to go ahead and register for your, for your free ticket for next month's show. And then there'll also be the event section for the conference. It'll be April 30th, May 1st, and 2nd. For anybody that's not a speaker and they want to buy their ticket, then you'll just click on that and you can get your ticket to the show.
Cool. Hey, thanks guys, Bart, Mr. Simpich. Thank you guys, David, Brian, Casey. All right, we'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Brian, you still with me here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Anything you want to add in closing, Brian?
KU won. There we go. Had to get that plug in there.
The Royals been having a hell of a good spring training. Let's see if they can carry it on the rest of the actual MLB season this year.
No, I just want to say that I thank you, everybody, for joining us. And it's always good to keep in touch. Hopefully see everybody and talk to everybody soon. So, especially Gary. Hi, Gary. Bye, Gary.
Hey, buddy. All
right. We're going to be coming down there next month probably, so make some room.
All right. I'll be looking for you. I'm going to hit leave, so good to be with all of you. Larry, good luck to you.
Anything you want to add, Gary, before you head out?
Well, it would take a few minutes, but and I'll catch you next time.
Okay.
Gary, you want to scan and email that gift, the deed of gift, the receipt you have. I'll take a quick look at it. And...
Okay. You brought up a good point, Larry, right at the first about why do you still do this after almost 60 years? And I ran across this. Hank Borelli, Al Borelli, posted this. Y'all know who Major Carlton Coon is? Mm-hmm. Nobody does. I didn't. And he was in the OSS World War II. In 1943, he contacted Donovan, William Donovan, the head, and he wrote this advocating agency adoption of political assassination. And listen to what he said. The world is now too small and too tight to permit continuation of the process of trial and error. A mistake made in one quarter will of necessity spread rapidly all over the world. For all our apples are now in one barrel, and if one rots, the lot is destroyed. We cannot be sure that the clear and objective scholars who study the existing social systems and draw blueprints for a society to suit our technology will always be heard, or that their plans will be put into operations. We can almost be sure that this will not be the case. Therefore, some other power, some third class of individuals aside from the leaders and scholars, must exist. And this third class must have the task of thwarting mistakes, diagnosing errors of political world, this elite equilibrium, and nipping the causes of potential disturbances in the bud. There must be a body of men whose task it is to throw out the rotten apples as soon as the first spots of decay appear. A body of this nature must exist undercover. It must either be a power unto itself or be given the broadest discretionary powers by the highest human authorities. Do we have that or do we not? That's the reason we still do this.
That's
it's
right.
Really amazing when you start reading the bios of the people that were at the upper echelons in the CIA post-World War II, is they really felt that they had an equal right to make foreign policy as the president. I mean, they were in this privileged class where they just felt this was their job. And, I mean, you know, they just, if the president didn't agree, they would just either undermine him or ignore him.
I think we have more of that than.
Yeah. And now the bureaucracy is even more entrenched.
More. That's right.
Yeah. And they
all right, guys, I'm leaving. Yeah. Good to be with all of you.
Take care,
Gary. Bye, Gary.
Okay.
Anybody else want to add anything? Larry, you want to finish that last statement you're working on?
Oh, it's just unfathomable when I read what they thought, and you could see how they could, you know, with Cuba, with Russia, they just thought they knew more than JFK. And you could see that, and they felt they were doing God's work, and that this is, you know, that they knew better. And you can't underestimate the paranoia about communism, and you know, if they felt that someone was, you know, soft on communism, they could take actions because they felt it was for the greater good. So it just, it's when people say, how could you think that someone working for a government agency could plot to kill the president? You got to look and see the times. And it was right after McCarthyism. And that didn't go away when McCarthy left.
Right. Well, Bart, I was going to just say thank you for uploading those documents or your article, the two articles, The Observer and the from the notes you had from
my pleasure. Sharing is caring.
Yeah, that was good stuff.
Okay. Yeah, especially the Mongoose stuff, because especially the first document, it draws a complete blank in Google. You know, I ran those RIF numbers, and I just, you know, once in a while there is a blank. Most of the time you see these numbers in the Federal Register, but Malcolm warned me beforehand and said, this is really rare stuff. And I thought, yeah, I've heard it all before, because then I run the RIF numbers, and they go, yeah, I've got this, I've got that, blah, blah, blah. And there were a few bits in there that I already that I did find on Mary Farrell. I've got to say that Mary Farrell really upped the ante over the last few years with regards to scanning documentation, and then still do, actually. It's just that website is just an absolute bastard to navigate through. It's true. It's a piece of shit. I hate it. I mean, I'm not kidding. Just from a user interface point of view, you know, if you can do it, I've probably said this last time, if you can do Google in its simplicity, then why do you have to make things so difficult? And my pal Neil Savity as well, he couldn't be here today because I think he's watching the rugby. But he said it as well. He says, I hate navigating through Mary Farrell's website to try and find stuff. And I said, yeah, there's too many distractions in his user interface as such. And the same goes for when I store all the documents on Google Drive, and it's just, I love it. It's simplicity and how it finds things and how it just categorizes things and so forth. It's just easy, and that's how it should be. You know, you've got to basically treat your visitors as a 9-year-old that you can't visit anything. So that's the main aim for me doing that as such. And, you know, Malcolm, I said to Malcolm 3 days ago, I'm bored, send me some stuff, because I'm not seeing him until April the 8th. When lockdown is being relaxed and I can finally go back into the warehouse. I basically raided the warehouse last time. I took back 20 big bags with me, and which is roughly about, I'd say, 10 drawers from a filing cabinet. And I just basically wanted to, I'm going there and I'm going to plunder everything that's left to do. So I have absolutely no idea how much is left. I think I've done a fair amount over 2.5 years time, but I've been surprised every time. Every time I think, it'll be all right, blah, blah, blah. But then it just goes into such an enormity that I can't take it with me. I can't carry it. Or even the car is just basically full up with bags of documentation and such.
Let me ask you for just a moment. Because I appreciate what you're saying, but why do you feel that Mary Farrell is too distracting? Because it has so many different ways you can go into a rabbit hole, if you will.
If you are searching, then I want to determine what I'm searching. So if I put the name in, I don't want to see videos, books, magazines, and so forth. I just want to take documents and basically get one page that shows these documents. So I basically have to go through all these sections, and also the way the summarizations go. You know what? People should take an example of Harold Weisberg's archive. It is the most simplistic thing, but the search engine is excellent, and it finds everything that you're looking for. And that simplistic approach is the best approach. Like from a user interface, I only want to do that. I only want to find this. I mean, even UNT has it. It allows you to search between videos, documents, pictures, and so forth. It's tantamount that you just find really quickly what you're looking for and not get distracted by other things. Now, that's an ambiguous term in the description as such. But then, like I said, take Google as an example and take Google Drive and take Harold Weisberg's archive as an example, and you will find that stuff and you don't get distracted by other things. I don't want to be lured into clicking anything else. Anything.
Lured is the word.
Yeah, I want a white page with just a short description, and I want to see the name highlighted in that description so I know in what conjunction that name, that search term of mine is basically coming back at. And, you know, some people look into this and they do it really carefully, and some people just don't. And, I've been a member for Mary Farrell twice, and I just dropped the membership at that point because I didn't feel it needing it. And on top of that, I was just like, oh, you know what, I can't be asked to go through this because it's so frustrating. At RRKC, sometimes I just basically threw a term into our little group channel and said, can somebody try and find this for me, because I'm ready to shut the internet down because I can't be asked to go through this crap and can't find what I'm looking for. And then somebody else goes, yeah, I found it. And I'm like, great. But, you know, I'm just too distracted by all the other stuff as such. I just keep it simple. You know, I mean, that's what you want. You want people to find this stuff. 1, 2, 3. And not like, oh, yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, there's a movie of this and there's a banner of that. No, forget about it. Get rid of it. Boom. Just stick to the documentation or stick to the videos and get a nice layout that works into a responsive design, basically, that works really well if you are using a tablet, phone, or a laptop or a desktop whatsoever. It just needs to be really simple. But I've had to use Mary Farrell a lot lately because it is only in the last 9 months that I've basically started to punch riff numbers in, because at first when I started working on Malcolm's archive, it was only meant to be a 4 or 5 month job, because then the stuff was going to be sent away and it never happened. And that I checked the numbers and went through the Mary Farrell site a lot. And you know what? Look at the government site, the NARA site, when they publish the documents as such. That's simple as well. You know, I mean, it's a disgrace that they can't put descriptions in with the amount of years that they've had at their disposal to basically go through these documents and so forth. But, you know, it's still, it is a simple site to go through and to find documents. So that's what I think Mary Farrell should do in the next update of their website, and just make it easier and simple.
Well, that's an interesting observation. I'm on the other side of the fence on that, but I think your observation is... No. I think his observation is just as valid as mine. Everybody does this stuff in different ways. I love the distractions. I love the film. I love the other summaries. I wouldn't have it any other way. But I understand what you're saying, because I spend a lot of time grousing because I do that.
I don't. Yeah, because I get distracted already enough anyway. So because I look at my browser, there's at least 20 tabs open, at least. Some of them have been open.
I got 35 open right now.
Yeah, but you see, and it just slows your machine down. But the thing is, it's just that when I'm researching, when I'm looking for things, I don't want to mess about. I want the stuff. I know it's there, so I want to find it. I want to grab it, and I want to move on. And just say, no, watch this movie first. Or, no, look at this. And, oh, no, do you know about that? No, I don't want to know. I want the document because I want to focus on that goddamn article. You know, I'll tell you what, Bill. I spend on average between 10 and 16 hours a day on this stuff, 7 days a week. So, and I'm getting it to a point where I'm getting impatient. I'm old, so I'm not as old as some of you, but I'm getting old in thinking and going, give it to me. Just stop messing about. And on top of that, it's just that I want to get the articles over and done with. I'm going to take a long break probably at the end of this year, because I'll probably have finished Malcolm's archive and my articles, and then I'm just going to take a break from it all for a bit. You know, I've got to. I've got to get the virus out of my system.
Well, you're doing great work. That's all.
Oh, thank you. But,
well,
you know.
To kind of throw in there, Bart, the way that we're doing, like, Dick Russell's collection, you know, I was able to sit down and talk with Clayton Ogilvy that did Weisberg's site, and he's the one that digitized all of his documents. And I know that not all of them are digitized, even on – I think it's even on Weisberg's site, it's like 85% of it's done. And there's still more stuff out there that hasn't been uploaded yet. But the way we're doing it, like with Dick Russell's, I mean, we pull out a box, and then you'll be able to click on the box name, and then folder one, what it is, folder two, what it is. Baylor did a great job with, you know, sorting out his files and putting things where they need to go and making it easier for us to digitize. Oh. And we want to make it as easy as possible for researchers to be able to go through, going, okay, I want to look at this. They don't have to go through all that other, you know, crap in the background. They can just go right to that folder and look. Of course, we want people to see everything he's got. That's why we're doing it.
Put it on Google Drive. Put it on Google Drive, because Google Drive notes all the words in the document. So the OCR is also being applied through Google Drive. That's how I found that document we just discussed about that person that's connected to Ruby.
Yeah.
I've got in my description, there's no mention of that person. Yeah, it's in that document as such. So basically, boom, it just finds that as such. So
yeah,
once I publish the entire archive with Malcolm, it's, you know, it's searchable by itself as well. So it's just brilliant. I love it.
Google's AI that they've got built in with Google Drive, the AI they use, it makes it really easy to be able to find something that you're looking for.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. But I'm going to do a project that involves, it's called Cognitive Search. And I don't know if you ever watched this. I think this is in 2018. There were two guys at Microsoft, and they had a stack of JFK documents, and they used their algorithms in searching. And then in the end, they had a maze, like a spider web, but a sphere model. And what they did was they put their artificial intelligence not on the actual text, but also on the stamps and on the signatures, once they basically knew whose signature was whose. I mean, Hoover had a particular signature that's relatively easy to identify. Once they managed to find out all these bits, then you get a complete different search, because then you know who's seen that document, who sent that document, who okayed that document, and so forth. It just basically adds another layer to the actual document itself. And I must say, if you put on an algorithm that can go through JFK documentation, then that algorithm will kill everything else, because if you look at the state of some of the FBI documents as such, with all the stamps and all the little signatures all the way around and everywhere. So if we can do that, then that's just simply awesome, and it just creates another layer within that document. And that's what I'm eventually aiming for, but that'll be a year or two from now when that's finished. But that's an idea where I'm toying with seriously. And then
that's actually a good idea.
Yeah, well, it's just basically to expand the search and just put a, well, for lack of a better word, a 3D element to the actual search, and that extra layer basically on top of it, and find out as such who signed what, who did this, who sent this. Because also, a lot of the documents have stamps on them. The stamps go over text and so forth. So, you know, learning to differentiate. And the technique becomes better and better, because the other day, about a week or 2 weeks ago, the Dutch postmaster in the late 18th century, in the late 1700s, when he couldn't deliver a letter, he would throw them in a box. And after a while, they basically had this box filled with letters. Now, these letters were filled all in their own specific way. And certain letters, they opened up, but certain letters, they didn't, because it had a wax seal on the back. So what they did then was do a CT scan of these letters, and combined with an algorithm, they basically managed to unfold these letters digitally. Yeah, and read the contact. And of course, that's handwritten. Yeah, that's not typed. That's handwritten. So that's how good the technology has become already, basically to distinguish and basically to fold the letter open digitally while it's closed, and then just basically go through the handwriting and able to differentiate and translate and basically write the contents of these letters. That's simply amazing. So that's how good the technology already is becoming with doing things like that. So give it a couple of years, then it should be a walk in the park.
All right. Well, if anybody has anything else to say, that go ahead and speak up now, or we'll bring the
one question.
Go ahead, Bart.
Joe, where the hell are you? Are you in a restaurant or in a bar?
It's the Guinness bar.
Oh. Okay. Oh, I can see it. Yeah, behind you. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Also yourself.
Hmm?
Also yourself.
Yes.
He's so consistent.
It's wallpaper, I bet.
Good on you. All right. Well, thanks very much. It was a great meet.
Well, thanks again. And I want to thank everybody that's still with us on our journey meeting for the month of March of 2021. Thank you, everybody, for showing up. We'll have the new invite on through email and also on the projectjfk.com website for April the 17th at p.m. Central Standard Time. And, again, our next conference is going to be April 30th, May 1st, May 2nd, during that weekend. And those details, list of speakers, schedule, and all that good stuff will be up on the event tab on projectjfk.com. So if anybody else doesn't have anything else to say, then we'll close out the meeting.
Thanks, guys.
Everybody take care, stay safe, and we'll see you next month.